Good afternoon, everyone. I'd like you to take your seats so we can get this session started. My name is Sharon Walmsley. I'm from the University of Toronto, and I am the Track B co-chair of this conference. We are very pleased that we've been able to extend the Track B late breaker session because of the quality of the abstracts that we have received this year. So we really do have a marathon this afternoon. Dr. Pedro Kahn from Argentina, who is the incumbent IAS president, is my co-chair for this first half of the late breaker sessions. In total, we will be having 18 presentations. Each speaker will have 7 minutes for their talk, 3 minutes for questions. We absolutely have no give in the program, so we are going to ask the speakers to keep on time. And if you do have a question, it needs to be short and to the point. And similarly, the answers will also have to be short and to the point. Look forward to hearing these fabulous presentations. The abstracts are in this special supplement, the green one that was found in your bag if you're looking for the abstracts for this session. So without further ado, I'd like to open this session. Our first talk will be given by Dr. Bill Cameron from the University of Ottawa. His title is a 2-year randomized controlled clinical trial in antiretroviral-naive subjects using lopinavir-ritonavir monotherapy after induction treatment as compared to an efavirenz 3-drug regime, study MO3613. Welcome, Bill.
Thank you very much, Madam, Mr. Chair, ladies and gentlemen. I'm happy to present to you here the results of a 2-year randomized controlled clinical trial in first treated patients with HIV infection using lopinavir and zidovudine-lamivudine induction followed by monotherapy versus a standard efavirenz zidovudine-lamivudine triple regimen. The study design took patients who were previously untreated with any CD4 T cell count at outset, were screened for eligibility criteria, and randomized 2-to-1 to either a standard regimen of efavirenz and zidovudine-lamivudine for 96 weeks, and the twice as many patients randomized to a group treated with lopinavir, ritonavir, and zidovudine-lamivudine for 3 months, who would then, after 3 months continuous treatment, if achieving virologic suppression below 50 copies per milliliter for a further 3 consecutive months, opt to continue with lopinavir-ritonavir monotherapy thereafter. The primary outcome in the trial was a virus load below 50 copies per milliliter at week 96, or 2 years from enrollment, and the primary analysis was intention to treat with prior failure of less than 50 copies on 2 consecutive monthly measures carried forward as failure from that point of the first virus load above 50 copies on monotherapy. The patients enrolled were 100 in the lopinavir-ritonavir group, about 50 in the efavirenz group. Patients were mostly male, mostly 40, mostly virus load 100,000 copies, CD4 count above 200 cells per microliter on average, and mostly Caucasian. The disposition of studies from 155 randomized was 2-to-1, as I mentioned, to the lopinavir versus efavirenz groups. And to make a long story short, by the end of the trial, about 70% in each group ended up finishing the study on their intended treatment strategy. Discontinuations were, in total, about 25% in each group with no significant difference and no predominant difference in reason for study discontinuation throughout. The primary analysis, as I mentioned, was an intention to treat for proportion under 50 copies 2 years from entry to study, and you can see here that there was no significant difference, after all, in this outcome, recognizing, of course, that patients who went above 50 copies on two measures were classified as failure from that point, which would have begun about 6 months into the trial. If we look at a different sort of analysis, again, intent to treat, where patients were simply classified according to their virus load at the time of follow-up, you can see that there was no discernible difference in outcome between the two arms. And another way to look at this, to classify the degree of virologic rebound that might have occurred, would be to compare the two groups for virologic rebound to about 500 copies per milliliter. And again, you can see that there is no discernible difference seen, or no statistically significant difference seen between the two groups. Another way to analyze this outcome would be to look at those patients from the time they began lopinavir, ritonavir monotherapy as early as 6 months after entry into the trial, and compare them with a population of patients on the efavirenz-treated arm who had achieved the same criteria which would have permitted de-intensification or monotherapy had they been in the lopinavir treatment arm. And you can see that there is a steady accrual of patients who achieved two blips above 50 copies per milliliter in the Kaletra or the lopinavir-ritonavir monotherapy arm compared with the comparable patients in the other arm, which was statistically significant. If we classified failure more forgivingly at 500 copies per milliliter, and again time to that event, we see no significant difference between the two arms. This illustrates to us that most of the virologic breakthrough was low level, and the earlier analyses showed us that it was transient. The most simple kind of pictorial analysis of disposition and virologic status of patients throughout the course of this trial is illustrated here, where the top light blue color represents those patients who discontinued trial. You can see that slightly more in the efavirenz-treated group discontinued study than in the lopinavir group. And you can see that another difference appearing between the two arms in the study is that after 6 months, there is a steady trickle of patients here with virus loads between 50 and 500 copies per milliliter, but no real difference in the number of patients who are breaking through above 500 copies per milliliter. And as well, in each group, the majority of patients are suppressed below 50 copies throughout their study participation. If we try to look then at the outcome of virus load breakthrough on monotherapy, we can see that the majority of patients above 500 copies per milliliter on the monotherapy arm resuppressed with reintroduction of zidovudine, lamivudine, and the majority of patients on the monotherapy arm with low-level breakthrough resuppressed, again, without reintroduction for the most part of zidovudine, lamivudine. So it was a blip that remitted. We saw no difference in CD4 T-cell count response between arms. And we looked for genotypic resistance mutations appearing in patients with virologic breakthrough and genotyping results available, and we found the same rough and infrequent proportion of patients with genotypic mutations detected in each arm. In summary, then, with successful lopinavir, zidovudine, lamivudine treatment, subsequent lopinavir monotherapy continuously maintained virus load suppression in a large proportion of patients, not different than seen in the other arm. The patients receiving monotherapy experienced more breakthrough, low level, to 500 copies. This was usually in that range, 50 to 500 copies per mil, was generally resuppressed spontaneously to below 50 copies per mil, and detection of drug resistance mutations did not differ in proportion between the two groups of patients. Lastly, lopinavir-ritonavir monotherapy may become or may provide an alternative treatment option for selected patients. Thank you.
Are there any questions for Dr. Cameron?
So what questions?
microphone too.
Hi, John Mellors, University of Pittsburgh. Bill, did you look at viral load in the semen or genital tract or CSF?
No.
That is the most succinct I've ever heard, Dr. Cameron. Are there any other questions? Over microphone. Can we have the microphone on?
Yes, hi. Can you tell us what the PI mutation was that you found?
No.
Microphone two, last question.
Go ahead.
Microphone
Hello.
Two.
Yep. Dr. Uskare from Bombay. What was the triglyceride level after, say, 96 weeks? Was it all acceptable? Lopinavir.
Triglycerides.
Triglyceride levels, we have that information, and I think that it will be, I don't know the numbers, but it would be quite in keeping with what has been observed in past studies in Kaletra trials, and you would expect it to be elevated compared to the comparator arm.
Thank you, Bill. We'll move on. The second abstract. It's number 202, entitled The Monarch Trial, a 48-week analysis of lopinavir-ritonavir monotherapy compared to lopinavir-ritonavir plus zidovudine-lamivudine in antiretroviral-naive patients, to be presented by Dr. Delfrazy on behalf of his investigators.
Thanks to the organizer to invite me to present the first results of the MONARCH trial. MONARCH trial is a pilot, open-label, randomized trial to compare the safety and efficacy of lopinavir-ritonavir alone in comparison to triple therapy in naive patients. Patients were naive with a viral load lower than 100,000 copies and CD4 higher than 100. Baseline characteristics for viral load and CD4 cell count were comparable in the two groups, and the primary efficacy endpoint was the proportion of patients with viral load lower than 400 copies on week 24 and with viral load lower than 50 copies on week 48. That's the subject disposition during the trial. We were 83 patients randomized in the monotherapy arm and 53 patients randomized in the triple combination. We have a slight high rate of discontinuation that's observed in both arms. What are the results? For efficacy endpoint, we look first in intent to treat analysis, missing egal failure. And we observe that in the monotherapy arm with lopinavir-ritonavir, 71% of the patients are viral load lower than 50 copy on week 48, and 65% of the patients reach the endpoint with point 1 and point 2. It's comparable to the triple arm combination. When we look on patient on treatment, with available viral loads, the results were different. Clearly, we have in the lopinavir-ritonavir monotherapy arm, 84% of the patients who are viral load lower than 50 copies at the end of the trial, and 80% with 0.1 and 0.2 for primary endpoints. And these results are different from the arm with AZT3DC and lopinavir, and there is a significant statistically difference. The curves of the decrease of viral load to 400 copies in intent to treat analysis is similar in both groups and is also similar on patient on treatment. The curve of decrease of viral load lower than 50 copies is slightly lower in the monotherapy arm in intent to treat analysis and is clearly lower in the monotherapy arm on patient on treatment. In the same graph as the first presentation, this graph shows you all the viral load measured in each patient during the trial as defined in the protocol. And clearly, you see exactly the same thing as for in maintenance therapy. There is a proportion of patients in the monotherapy arm we have a viral load between 50 copies and 400 copies, and the difference with the triple arm combination is clearly different. We observe no clear difference for the CD4 cell count increase, and the increase of CD4 cell count in the monotherapy arm is approximately about 150 CD4 cells. We perform resistant testing for genotypic and phenotypic analysis in patients with viral load higher than 500 copies during the trial. In the monotherapy arm, we observed two patients with genotypic mutation associated with resistance to PI, none in the triple arm combination, and one mutation associated in this arm to the 3TC resistance. In both patients with genotypic associated mutation to PI, we do not observe phenotypic resistance and phenotypic change. The genotypic mutation were associated with mutation in codon 10 and 82 in the first patients, and associated with mutation in 46 in the second patient. Both patients were retreated, one with lopinavir, ritonavir alone, and the other with intensification with AZT and 3DC and lopinavir, ritonavir, and both patients had viral load lower than 50 copy undetectable after 4 weeks of treatment. In conclusion, initiating antiretroviral therapy with lopinavir monotherapy demonstrated clearly a sustained biological efficacy. Lopinavir monotherapy was associated with more episodes of viremia between 50 and 400 copies compared with the triple arm free drugs therapy. These results are in keeping with recent results of other NRTI sparing first line trials, as for example Hippocamp, which is an NRS trial conducted by Christine Kaplama. And clearly at that time for the guideline, my position is that monotherapy with lopinavir ritonavir should not be recommended for all naive patients. However, further ongoing analysis, and for example, proviral DNA, PK, and adherence studies, but also quality of life, my health, defining predictive factors that identify probably a large subset of naive patients for whom such a strategy can be proposed. Moreover, these results in naive patients suggest that such a lopinavir monotherapy warrants further evaluation, particularly for maintenance simplification therapy. Thank you for your attention.
This paper is open for questions. Microphone 3.
Good afternoon, St. Mary's Hospital, Fabiola Martin, UK. My question is, what was the mean time at which the resistance tests were performed?
I don't know. It was probably between 24 weeks, 28 weeks. 28
and,
weeks.
Yeah. Do you have any resistance data beyond 48 weeks?
No.
Charles, microphone 3.
Charles Boucher, the Netherlands. I was wondering, in the monotherapy, is there a relationship between the initial viral load and the chance of failure?
As you have seen, I give not the results of multivariable analysis because we are doing that. I can only say that all patients with viral load lower than 30,000 copies have a viral load at the end of the trial lower than 50 copies.
Okay, microphone 4.
Additionally, we have also some results for the other question, the question for the first speaker. We have also results in the semen, and clearly we have the same results as for tree therapy for the semen with the hormonotherapy.
Okay, sorry, microphone two.
Have you results from plasma levels in the failing patients? Plasma levels? Drug levels in the plasma?
Yes, we have performed a PK analysis, and we at that time we have not all the results, so we don't present the results today. But clearly we have to make the relationship between PK and the viral efficacy.
Microphone one.
Yeah, did you measure adherence? And if you do, how do you measure it?
Sorry, but we don't have anything at my place. Or perhaps I have some problems. The tolerance was good in the two groups, and we have no difference in major side effects in the two groups. As you have seen, the trial was performed with soft gel capsule, the old one.
Okay, Julio, last question.
Can you comment on CSF penetration of Calitra monotherapy?
That's a very good question, as you know, Jorge. And I have no results at that time. As you know, there is some results in the literature on the penetration of Calitra in the CSF. We anticipate such a problem with a work with Christine Rizou on the penetration of Calitra in the seminal fluid and on the reservoir. And at that time, we have probably good results for the reservoir in the seminal fluid.
Thank you. Okay, the third abstract on this theme is abstract 203, which is entitled Lopinavir-Ritonavir as Single Drug Maintenance Therapy in Patients with HIV-1 Viral Suppression, 48-week results of a randomized controlled open-label clinical trial, the OK-04 study, to be presented by Dr. Arabis.
Good afternoon. The OK-04 study is a randomized clinical trial which has included HIV-infected patients who have been undetectable for more than 6 months, who had no history of virological failure while taking a PI, and who were receiving lopinavir-ritonavir plus 2 nucleosides for at least 1 month prior to randomization. And these type of patients were randomized to stop the nucleosides, it's the only Calitra or OK arm, and continue taking lopinavir-ritonavir subgel capsule. The Meltrex formulation was not used in this study. Or patients were randomized to continue the 2 nucleosides and lopinavir-ritonavir. This is a triple therapy arm. The study is going to be followed up to 2 years. For most part of the study, patients have been followed every 3 months. The primary endpoint of the study, which I'm going to present here today, is the proportion of patients with therapeutic failure at 48 weeks. We define in this study therapeutic failure as having 2 viral loads more than 500 2 weeks apart, but there is an important exception. Patients who are on monotherapy, who have a confirmed rebound, who don't have mutations in the protein gene, and who are successfully reinduced with nucleosides are not considered therapeutic failures. Change of randomized therapy, treatment discontinuation, or loss to follow-up is a therapeutic failure. With 100 patients per arm, the study has an 80% power to show the non-inferiority, choosing a non-inferiority margin of 12% and assuming an efficacy rate of 90% of both arms based in our prior pilot trial. As you can see here in this slide, both arms were well balanced at baseline. Half of the patients were co-infected with hepatitis C. And it's important to note that these patients have been undetectable for a very prolonged period of time, 19 months in the OK arm, 17 months in the triple therapy arm. Baseline CD4 were rather high, close to 500 in both arms. This is in keeping with the long time they've been undetectable, although another CD4 in these patients have been pretty low, close to 100. Of all patients who entered the trial, 198 were randomized and dosed, and you can see here the disposition of the 100 patients who were randomized to lopinavir ritonavir alone. After 1 year, 89 are still taking only Kaletra. The 11 patients missing are 6 patients who had loss of virological control. 5 of these 6 patients were reinduced with nucleosides. There was 1 patient who was reinduced without loss of virological control. There are 3 lost to follow-ups and 1 change in randomized treatment. Of the 98 patients who continue taking the 2 nucleosides and lopinavir ritonavir, 88 after 1 year are still taking this combination. The other 10 patients have 3 loss of virological control, 3 discontinuation due to adverse events, and 4 patients who were lost to follow-up. Here you can see the primary endpoint, the proportion of patients without therapeutic failure at week 48. This endpoint includes only 4 patients who were in the monotherapy and who were successfully reinduced. You can see here that 94% in the monotherapy arm didn't have therapeutic failure, compared to 89.8% in the triple therapy arm, for a point estimate of minus 4.2%. You can see the upper limit of this confidence interval is 3.4%, which is within the specified non-inferiority margin. In these Kaplan-Meier curves, you can see time to therapeutic failure. You can see that by log rank test, there is not a significant difference. This is an important sensitivity analysis that we have done. It's an strict analysis, including is the proportion of patients with less than 50 copies per ml by intention to treat, missing data equals failure, and also in this analysis, reinduction is equals failure. So this analysis, the 4 patients who were successfully reinduced are considered failures despite the fact that they are undetectable at 48 weeks. Here the proportions of patients undetectable on triple therapy is 89.8%. In monotherapy arm is 85%. This is not a significant difference. In this slide, you can see the point prevalence of discontinuation and virological response per arm. The big green area are patients who are on a study and have HIV RNA less than 50 copies. The blue area is patients who are on a study and have between 50 and 500 copies per ml. You can see this is slightly bigger in the OK arm than the triple therapy arm. A minority of patients are in the orange area. At each time point, there are patients on a study who have HIV RNA more than 500, and the light blue is patients who are discontinued from the trial. We saw very little change in CD4 cell count. This is in keeping with the high CD4 cell counts that patients had at baseline. These patients, most of them have been on Kaletra for a prolonged period of time. They were tolerating Kaletra, so we saw very little discontinuation due to adverse events such as diarrhea or other adverse events. In terms of grade 3 and 4 laboratory abnormalities, there were 3% of patients in each arm who had grade 3 and 4 triglycerides, and there was 10% in the OK arm who had grade 3 or 4 cholesterol, and 4% in the triple therapy arm. We genotype in the study each patient who has at least one viral load above 500, regardless of if the subsequent sample was undetectable or not. Of the 11 patients who were genotyped in the OK arm, 2 patients had primary PI mutations for a prevalence of resistance of 2%. In the triple therapy arm, 1 patient had primary PI mutations for a prevalence of 1%. We genotyped 4 patients in the triple therapy arm. So the main conclusion of the trial is after 48 weeks, lopinavir-ritonavir monotherapy was non-inferior to lopinavir-ritonavir plus 2 nucleosides in the proportion of patients without therapeutic failure. The majority, 85% of patients on lopinavir-ritonavir monotherapy maintained viral suppression without nucleosides. After having done the pilot trial and this bigger trial, I would like to share with you what we think are the therapeutic implications of these findings. So the question we're very interested in is how many patients treated with lopinavir ritonavir do not need 2 nucleosides to maintain HIV RNA less than 50 copies per ml. We believe our estimate is that around 85% of the patients don't appear to need the nucleosides in the setting that we have designed the trial. 10% of the patients have obvious episodes of non-adherence. In these patients, virological suppression is lost, and the risk of developing mutations appear less than with other simplification strategies. Then we have a minority of patients that we estimate around 5% that have persistent, stable, low-level rebound without obvious non-adherence. The cause and the source of this viremia is at present unknown. In the absence of PI resistance, these patients can be controlled, adding back the nucleosides, but I will caution everybody that if these patients are continue replicating, it's clearly a risk of developing PI resistance. We believe that exposure to a monitoring period of lopinavir-ritonavir monotherapy in order to determine if triple therapy is needed is a feasible strategy. Let me finish thanking all the patients who participated in the trial and also all the investigators, specifically Dr. Pulido, who's been working with me in this project for 4 years, and in Abbott, Esther Cabrero, Michael Norton, and Isabel Gaultier. Thank you for your attention.
There is time for one question only, which will be microphone 3.
Have you seen, did you check if there is different triglyceride level with FC patient? Is this FC negative?
I know we haven't looked at that. We haven't looked at that.
Okay, thank you, Jose. The next abstract is abstract 204, a prospective randomized phase 3 trial of NRTI, PI, and NNRTI sparing regimens for initial treatment of HIV-1 infection, ACTG study 5142, to be presented by Dr. Ridler.
Thank you. On behalf of the ACTG protocol study team and my co-chair, Richard Helbrick, I'm pleased to present the primary analysis of A5142, a prospective randomized phase 3 trial of class-sparing regimens for initial treatment of HIV. The U.S. Department of Health and Human Services recommended regimens for initial therapy of HIV infection, specifically lopinavir and efavirenz, each with two nucleosides, have not been compared in an adequately powered randomized clinical trial. The potent nucleoside-sparing regimen of efavirenz plus lopinavir has likewise not been evaluated in large randomized studies. A5142 is a multicenter, open-label, randomized clinical trial. The study population included antiretroviral-naive individuals with HIV RNA greater than 2,000 copies and any CD4 cell count. Eligible participants were randomized equally to one of three arms: lopinavir soft gel capsules plus efavirenz, lopinavir soft gel capsules plus two nucleosides, and efavirenz plus two nucleosides. The nucleosides used in the study were 3TC plus the choice of zidovudine, D4TXR, or tenofovir, with the selection made prior to randomization. Randomization was stratified by HIV RNA, hepatitis co-infection, and selection of NRTIs. The two co-primary objectives of the study were first to compare pairwise between arms the time to virologic failure, where virologic failure was defined early as lack of suppression by one log or rebound before week 32, and late as failure to suppress to less than 200 copies or rebound at or after week 32. The second primary objective was to compare pairwise between arms the time to regimen completion, where regimen completion is defined as virologic failure or toxicity-related discontinuation of any regimen component. The data presented today are updated from the published abstract. All analyses are intention to treat. The significance threshold for the two primary endpoints is 0.016, after adjustment for the two co-primary endpoints, the multiple pairwise comparisons, and the interim analyses which were conducted for the DSMB. Subjects with regimen completion due to toxicity were followed for virologic failure for the remainder of the study. Subjects who discontinued without reaching a primary endpoint were censored. A total of 753 subjects were enrolled and included 20% women and 64% were non-white. The median baseline CD4 cell count was 182. The median HIV RNA at baseline was 100,000 copies. The selected nucleoside was 42% zidovudine, 24% D4T-XR, and 34% tenofovir. There were no significant differences in baseline characteristics between the three arms. The median follow-up was 112 weeks. The time to virologic failure was significantly shorter in the lopinavir plus two nucleoside arm, shown here in red, as compared to the efavirenz plus two nucleoside, shown here in yellow, with a stratified log rank p-value of 0.006. The proportion of subjects without virologic failure at week 96 was 76% for efavirenz, 73% for lopinavir efavirenz, and 67% for the lopinavir plus two nucleoside arm. There was a trend towards shorter time to regimen completion for the lopinavir plus two nucleoside arm compared to the efavirenz plus two nucleoside arm, with a p-value of 0.02, which does not reach the significance threshold. There was no difference in time to first treatment-limiting toxicity in the three arms. 19% of subjects overall had a new grade 3 or 4 sign or symptom during study follow-up, and 37% had one or more new grade 3 or 4 laboratory events. The somewhat higher proportion of laboratory events in the lopinavir efavirenz arm appears to be driven primarily by increases in serum lipids. However, formal analyses of specific toxicities have not been completed. This slide shows the proportion of individuals with HIV RNA less than 200 copies by study week. These data are intention to treat, and missing values are ignored. At week 96, the proportion with less than 200 copies is 93% in the efavirenz arm, 92% in the lopinavir plus efavirenz arm, and 86% in the lopinavir arm. The difference between the lopinavir and efavirenz arms is significant, with a p-value of 0.041. At week 96, the proportion with less than 50 copies is 89% in the efavirenz arm, 83% in the lopinavir plus efavirenz arm, and 77% in the lopinavir arm. Again, the significance there's a significant difference between lopinavir and efavirenz with a p-value of 0.003. Median CD4 cell counts increased in all three arms throughout the study period. At week 96, there is a significantly higher median increase in CD4 cells for the two lopinavir-containing regimens, each compared to the efavirenz regimen, with p-values of 0.01. for each comparison. At the present time, genotypic resistance data is available for 124 of the 227 subjects at the time of virologic failure. NRTI resistance mutations are observed in 10%, 15%, and 33% of the available genotypes, with the most common NRTI mutation at M184V. NNRTI resistance was observed in 69%, 4%, and 48% of the available samples, with the most common mutation being K103N. Major PI mutations were rare, occurring in only two subjects. Mutations in two drug classes were more frequently observed in the efavirenz plus two nucleoside arm. In conclusion, compared with a regimen of efavirenz plus two nucleosides, lopinavir plus two nucleosides had a significantly shorter time to virologic failure and tended to have a shorter time to regimen completion. The NRTI sparing regimen of lopinavir plus efavirenz had similar virologic efficacy and similar time to treatment-limiting toxicity as efavirenz plus two nucleosides. Preliminary resistance analyses show a trend toward more NNRTI resistance in the lopinavir efavirenz arm compared with efavirenz plus two nucleosides. And resistance mutations in two drug classes were more common in the efavirenz plus two nucleoside arm. Major PI mutations were rare. Finally, we'd like to thank the study volunteers, investigators, and study staff from the 55 participating ACTG sites. as well as the support from our pharmaceutical sponsors at Abbott, Bristol-Myers Squibb, and Gilead, and acknowledge the contribution of additional team members and many other individuals in ACTG. Thank you.
This paper is open for questions.
Over there.
Cal?
Four.
Oh, I'm sorry. Microphone four.
Hello? Yes. Hi, can you comment on the strata that were over 100,000 and whether there were any differences in efficacy or in resistance mutations on by baseline viral load?
Right. I can. We have not looked at that in terms of resistance. We have looked only preliminarily at the proportions with viral load less than the two thresholds of 250 and did not see differences in the below 100,000 and less than 100,000. We have not looked at time to virologic failure or regimen completion based on viral load, entry viral load or CD4 at this point. We will certainly do so.
Cal?
Calco in Boston. Do you have any explanation for the observation that you have more NNRTI mutations in the lopinavir favin, since we're used to lopinavir being associated with fewer mutations of the companion drugs, not more?
Well, we don't see PI mutations
right,
in that arm.
But you see non-mutations at a rate that seemed surprisingly high.
Yeah, granted, of course, it has to be taken into consideration that there were relatively few failures, so it's the proportion of failure samples that we have. We think that perhaps the twice-daily dosing of lopinavir provides less protection for the efavirenz compared to perhaps once-daily dosing of nucleosides in the other arm.
Last question in microphone four.
On the regimen completion, if you changed from AZT to D4T for anemia, was that considered a regimen failure with a single new substitute?
It was. It was. It was any change in the original randomized regimen.
Thank you. Moving on to abstract 205, this is entitled The Clean Study, Fosamprenivir plus Ritonavir versus Lopinavir-Ritonavir in antiretroviral-naive HIV-infected adults over 48 weeks. This paper is given by Dr. Joe Aron.
I'd like to thank the organizers, and I'm both honored and excited to present these results to you. I was actually going to shave my head and wear an earring and a white T-shirt, but I decided against that. So this study, first of all, couldn't take place without many, many, many investigators in Canada, United States, and Europe. And in particular, the study participants and the study coordinators and also the sponsors at GSK, especially Paul Wanamaker and Lisa Patel. The background for this study, I think, is obvious, but in the current DHHS guidelines, lopinavir-ritonavir in combination with 3TC and zidovudine is a first-line recommended regimen. There's evidence from other studies that fosamprenivir with ritonavir is potent and well-tolerated, but clearly a head-to-head comparison had not been done to this time. And again, abacavir 3TC fixed-dose combination provides a simplified Q-day dosing regimen that perhaps enhances adherence. So this is the study design. It's very straightforward. It's a phase 3 randomized study, open label, 1-to-1. It's a 48-week study, so there's no time past 48 weeks. Subjects were antiretroviral naive. They could have any CD4 cell count. They did have to have a detectable RNA greater than 1,000 copies. There was a stratification in the analysis above and below 100,000. And the study had 90% power to detect non-inferiority of the fosamprenivir-ritonavir arm within a 12% difference. I should point out that the study has already been published in The Lancet, and that study in the publication, obviously there will be details that I might have to move past quickly for the sake of time. Also, it's worth noting that patients that had an abacavir hypersensitivity reaction were not considered treatment failures. They were allowed to substitute another nucleoside. Zidovudine, of course, was provided, but they could choose any other nucleoside to continue on the study. The analysis is the Telover algorithm. It includes all subjects that were randomized and received at least one dose. Responders are those who reach below 400 copies and then don't have a confirmed treatment failure. Treatment failures are those people whose plasma RNA either never goes below 400 copies or has a confirmed rebound above 400 copies. If at week 48 the viral load was 400 copies and there wasn't an opportunity for that person to have that confirmed, that person was considered to have lost virologic response. It's important we also had a protocol-defined virologic failure. These are the patients whose viruses would undergo resistance testing. In this case, if someone had a single RNA below 400 copies and then had confirmed viral rebound above 400, they were considered a virologic failure. Or if they failed to achieve a viral load less than 400 by week 24, they were also considered a virologic failure. This is the geographic distribution. Note there are almost 900 patients randomized. 6% of the subjects came from Canada. These are the baseline demographics. I'll just point out that women made up 22% of the population. 42% of the population were people of color. 11% had a previous AIDS-defining diagnosis, and approximately 15% had active hepatitis B, hepatitis C, or both. Baseline virologic and immunologic characteristics. Baseline viral load was just over 100,000. Baseline CD4 cell count was 192. And you can see there was a fairly large proportion of patients that had CD4s less than 50 randomized into the study. These are the study outcomes by the Telover analysis. So 71% of patients randomized to fosamprenivir and 71% randomized to lopinavir were responders through 48 weeks. 6% and 7% met the definition of virologic non-response. And then there was a series of discontinuations, which are relatively balanced between the two treatment arms and predominantly dictated by either loss to follow-up or adverse event. Non-compliance here refers to investigator-determined non-compliance with the protocol. It does not necessarily mean that the patient was non-compliant specifically to one therapy or another. Note there were four deaths in the protocol prior to the Telover outcome. There was an additional death in a patient who actually met virologic failure criteria and then went on to have serious clinical complications and die. None of these were felt by investigators to be study treatment related. These are the primary results, less than 400 copies, again by the Telover analysis, 73% and 71%. This obviously met the non-inferiority definition. I can also tell you if you look at any other type of analysis, missing equals failure, observed data, which you see on the top part of the slide, the results are absolutely consistent throughout. The next two slides show some histograms, so you can look at the various strata. On the left is the overall result, and now on the right, as you look at it, are the results less than 400 based on various strata. You can see that greater or less than 100,000 copies, literally very, very similar results. And then by CD4 cell count, so subjects with even the lowest CD4 cell count responded as well as subjects with higher CD4 cell counts. And again, between treatment arms, the comparisons are similar, and then across strata, the comparisons are similar. Here's the same look with the less than 50 copy assay. So again, less than 50 copy Telover analysis, 66% and 65% were below 50 copies at 48 weeks. If you do a missing equals failure where subjects could have the opportunity to go back down below 50, these numbers are slightly higher, and those results are in the paper. And then you can see the stratifications by both RNA and CD4 and really no substantial differences in really any of the comparisons. Change in CD4 cell count, also similar, 176 and 191 was the median change in the two treatment arms. This is the resistance analysis. Remember, the protocol defined virologic failure required confirmation. There were 16 in the fosamprenivir arm, 24 in the lopinavir arm. Two and three were unable to be sequenced, and the majority in each arm did not have treatment emergent mutations. However, in the patients that did have treatment emergent mutations, there was one thymidine analog mutation. The 184V was relatively uncommon, three patients and four patients in the two treatment arms. Protease inhibitor-associated mutations did emerge. There were three on the fosamprenivir arm and two on the lopinavir-ritonavir arm. None of these met the IAS-USA criteria for major mutations, though the 54L mutation, which is associated with amprenivir, did emerge on the fosamprenivir treatment arm in one subject out of 440. These are the clinical treatment-related adverse events, grade 2 through 4. What you can see, again, it's really comparable across all categories. The parentheses, the percentage in the parentheses are the grade 3-4. So grade 3-4 clinical adverse events were quite uncommon. Down here, you can see that any abacavir HSR was considered a serious adverse event, regardless of grade, and there were 6% abacavir HSR overall. These are AEs leading to discontinuation of any study drug. So this is not discontinuation of the protocol, but discontinuation of any study drug. This was dominated by HSR to abacavir, which was 6%, but again, the vast majority of these patients actually switched their nucleoside and remained on protocol and in the primary analysis. And then you can see the other various adverse events leading to discontinuation of the treatment were uncommon and similar between treatment arms. These are the cholesterol and triglyceride changes, which are, again, parallel between the two treatment arms. These are LDL and HDL changes. This is median of the population. Again, you can see parallel between treatment arms. 11% of the patients were on lipid-lowering agents, and that was comparable between treatment arms. So finally, conclusions. Fosamprenivir-ritonavir had comparable efficacy to lopinavir-ritonavir using fixed-dose abacavir 3TC once-daily background. Few patients had protocol-defined failure. There were no major PI-associated mutations by IAS-USA and no reduced phenotypic susceptibility in the study. Regimens were well-tolerated. And just recently, both fosamprenivir-ritonavir and fixed-dose combination abacavir 3TC were added to the recommended components in the IAS-USA guidelines that were published this week. Thank you.
I'm afraid this paper went over time and there are no questions. We will move on. I'm going to turn the chair now over to Dr. Pedro Kahn for the next set of abstracts.
We are also switching chairs. So our next paper will be improving HIV screening with rapid testing and streamlined counseling. Now, this is my paper, but it's later on.
So
it's the
wrong.
Yeah.
It's the wrong set of, yeah.
0206 is the slide set that you should show.
There we go.
Okay. So improving HIV screening with rapid testing and streamlined counseling by Anaya and co-workers.
Thank you very much. Good afternoon. I'd like to first thank the organizing committee for allowing me to present the results of what I think is a very exciting HIV implementation project that is currently ongoing within the United States Department of Veterans Affairs. I must admit that I feel kind of like an odd duck up here, given that this is a non-clinical project that I'll be presenting, but I think if you stick with me for 10 minutes, I hope to convince you as to the relevance of this project. I would like to begin by first acknowledging the co-authors of the study, some of whom are in the audience this afternoon. Sorry, I missed dinner last night. I'd like to begin my presentation today by noting two main statistics, one of which you're probably aware of and one that I wasn't really aware of. The first is that current estimates are that approximately 45 million people worldwide are currently infected with HIV. The statistic that you may not be aware of, and the sad reality, is that estimates are that upwards of 95% of these people are unaware of their HIV positive status. It is imperative for trying to mitigate the HIV epidemic that people become aware of their status, because as research has shown, when people become aware of their HIV status, they tend to lessen their HIV-related risk behaviors, which in turn works to lessen the further spread of the pandemic. We chose the VA healthcare system to implement this HIV testing project, whose aim is twofold. The first is to not only increase testing, but also, and more importantly, to increase the rate at which people are receiving their HIV test results. We believe that the VA is an ideal place in which to conduct this project because, as we're finding out in a related project that we're currently involved in, even patients that are in care and who are seeing their doctors on a somewhat regular basis and who also have been targeted as being at additional risk for contracting HIV are not getting tested in nowhere near the numbers that they should be. So why is it that people aren't getting into care in the numbers that they should be? Well, the first main reason is simply that pre- and post-test counseling takes a lot of time. What we've tried to do to overcome this barrier is to incorporate a streamlined pre- and post-test counseling procedure into our study. The second is that many times doctors don't prioritize preventive tasks like HIV screening. We have taken the responsibility of HIV testing out of the hands of doctors and given it to nurses by incorporating a nurse-based screening protocol. And finally and simply, many times patients just don't come back to their hospital or clinic to get their HIV test results. What we have done to try to overcome this barrier is to incorporate an HIV rapid testing protocol. HIV rapid testing, as many of you may know, is a relatively new procedure for screening for HIV. Current methods employ either a finger stick or an oral swab. Rapid testing has been shown to be very effective in increasing the number of people who get the results because unlike the traditional HIV methods, which employ a two-visit process, the first to have the blood drawn and have the blood taken to the lab and have the lab results come back a week to 2 weeks later, rapid testing can give you your results in as little as 20 minutes. And I actually read a newspaper item in the paper a couple of days ago that there's a company here at the session this week that is trying to incorporate a test where you can actually get your results in as little as 3 minutes. So this technology is definitely marching on. Rapid testing has been shown to be effective in many types of healthcare settings, such as emergency and urgent care clinics, and has also been shown to be effective in certain types of public health settings, like STD clinics. But little, if any, research has been done in primary care or in primary care settings or within the VA. So I'll briefly go over our study design. Our study was designed as a randomized control intervention, which took place in the primary and urgent care clinics of the VA Los Angeles Medical Center. Patients who were waiting to see their doctors for their appointments that morning were asked if they wanted to participate in a project, and those that did were randomized to one of three models of screening. Our first was what we call our usual care model. Patients randomized to this model were simply prompted by our study recruiter to ask their doctor for an HIV test when they saw their doctor that morning. The second arm of our study is what we refer to as our nurse-based arm. In this arm, an HIV test referral was entered into the computer system by a research nurse, and then the nurse sent the patient to the lab for traditional pre- and post-counseling and traditional HIV testing. In our third arm, the difference between this arm and the second arm is there was still an HIV referral still being entered into the computerized system. The difference being is the research nurse was also administering the streamlined counseling and the rapid testing. We have four main study endpoints. The first is whether a patient got an HIV test order. The second is whether a patient ultimately received his or her results. The third is patient knowledge, which we are measuring by a pre- and post-intervention survey. And the fourth is a cost-effectiveness analysis that is currently ongoing. We are also looking at covariates. We're looking at patient demographics, HIV risk factors, and comorbid HIV conditions those being TB, a variety of STDs, and hepatitis B and C screening. This is a pictorial representation of our enrollment and randomization scheme. We had 283 people agree to participate in our project. After excluding 94 for issues of non-eligibility, we ultimately enrolled 189 patients into the project. They were randomized, as you can see below, 62 into our usual care condition, 64 into our nurse screening condition, and 63 into the combination of nurse screening rapid test condition. This table lists the demographic characteristics of our patient population. As you can see from these results, our patient population at the VA was primarily African American and tended to be relatively poor by U.S. standards. And also there were no significant differences between these three study groups. I'll now be discussing the two main endpoints, the first being whether a patient got an HIV test order. As you can see in our usual care condition where the patient was asking a doctor for a test, 40% of our patients in this arm actually got a test ordered. In our nurse screening arm, the results more than doubled. 84% of patients in our nurse screening arm got their results. And there was a slight increase to 92% when we look at the addition of rapid testing and streamlined counseling. When we turn to whether a patient ultimately received their results, our usual care condition did pretty badly. We only had 16% of patients in this arm who ultimately received their HIV test results. The results more than doubled when we evaluated our nurse screening arm, and more than doubled again when we looked at the arm with the addition of rapid testing and streamlined counseling. The magnitude and direction of these results surprised even us. So what can we conclude? In terms of test ordering, the addition of nurse screening increased test ordering when we compared it to our usual care condition. There was a slight non-significant increase with the addition of rapid testing and streamlined counseling. However, in terms of receipt of results, nurse screening increased our results when we compare it to the usual care condition, and there was also a significant increase with the addition of rapid testing, streamlined counseling. So, what implications can we draw from this study? The first thing that we're going to be looking at doing is trying to expand this project into the VA healthcare system on a nationwide basis. The second implication is we believe that this project and some elements of this project can be used as the basis for other similar outreach efforts. For example, we're using some elements of this project design in an outreach effort, pilot project outreach effort among homeless veterans in collaboration with Los Angeles County. And finally, we believe that this model can be used and be integrated by other healthcare systems which are similar to the VA in nature, those being large, probably more nationalized healthcare systems that tend to be decentralized. As I touched on the statistics at the beginning of my presentation today, HIV and the HIV pandemic continues to be very salient and powerful healthcare concern. We believe that these results are some very exciting preliminary results in not only increasing the number of people who are tested for HIV, but more importantly, increasing the number of people who ultimately receive their HIV test results. Thank you for your indulgence.
Thank you, Dr. Hagen. We have time for one quick question. Microphone three.
Thank you. It's Dr. Allen from United Kingdom. Your paper, if I remember right, over 50% of the patients in that study are between the age of 50 and 64. Am I right in thinking that?
Over 50% of the patients were over... The VA has a pretty an elderly patient population for the most part.
Don't you think in that situation the doctor is doing the test appropriately and the nurse screening protocol is inappropriate testing?
Well, as I mentioned at the beginning of my presentation, we are doing a similar set of research where we're looking at people who are in care and who we are flagging as being at risk for having HIV, and they are not getting tested and nowhere near the numbers they should be. So these patients just aren't getting tested. That's why it's imperative that we think about moving the paradigm away from doctors and into the hands of nurses who, you know, for whatever reason are more likely or have more time to, or, you know, with the advent of HIV rapid testing can give these types of tests more readily.
Thank you very much. We are running out of time. So thank you.
Thank you.
So we go to the next paper. It will be presented by Dr. Hakim from Zimbabwe. This is a stroke the treatment interruption strategy of 12-week cycles on and off ART is clinically inferior to continuous treatment in patients with low CD4 counts before ART, a randomization within the DART trial. Dr. Hakim.
Thank you. It's my pleasure on behalf of the DART study team to present this paper on a study that's nested within the main DART trial entitled a Structured Treatment Interruption, STI, strategy of 12-week cycles on and off ART is clinically inferior to continuous therapy in patients with low CD4 counts before antiretroviral therapy. The background is that intermittent therapy has the potential to reduce long-term toxicity, to reduce antiretroviral therapy costs, and to improve adherence. And all this, hopefully, whilst maintaining clinical well-being. One randomized trial in Côte d'Ivoire, the Trivacan study, which is a CD4-guided treatment interruption strategy, different from our DART strategy, has already reported inferiority of this strategy in comparison to continuous therapy. One worry we had was that there was great CD4 variability in our analysis, and therefore the feasibility of a CD4-guided strategy may have limitations. A brief description of the main DART trial design. 3,316 previously untreated HIV-infected patients in Uganda and Zimbabwe presenting with a CD4 count of less than 200 in WHO stages 2, 3, and 4, therefore fairly ill patients, were all put on antiretroviral drugs, but the comparison of interest was whether we could use clinical and laboratory monitoring versus clinical monitoring alone. And the study was planned for 4 to 5 years. And the primary endpoints were, there was an efficacy endpoint, which was new WHO stage 4 event or death, and a toxicity primary endpoint, serious adverse events. Describing the STI strategy, the nested study per se, this was a second randomization in a subset of patients with the same two endpoints as the main study. And these were patients who had achieved a CD4 count of 300 or greater after 48 or 72 weeks on antiretroviral therapy and were randomized either to STI or to continuous therapy. And the STI strategy here was cycles of treatment for 12 weeks and off treatment for 12 weeks. 813 patients were eligible for this study and were randomized between July 2004 and March 2006. Following the second DSMC review in March 2006, based on data that was collected up to mid-January 2006, the STI and continuous therapy randomization was terminated in the middle of March 2006, and all patients were moved to continuous therapy. Results, there were 405 patients randomized to continuous therapy and 408 randomized to STI. The only important aspects of the characteristics that I would like to draw your attention to are that most of the participants were female. In fact, three-quarters of the participants were female. Follow-up and antiretroviral therapy received. There was good compliance to the strategy that the participants were randomized to. If you look at the continuous treatment arm, triple therapy was given 99% of the time during the period of the study. And looking at the STI arm, triple therapy was given 50% of the time, i.e. there was good compliance with the randomization strategy. And this cartoon shows that fact. Going on to the results, a summary of the clinical outcomes. If we look at the main efficacy outcome, new WHO stage 4 and death was observed in 24 STI participants and 9 continuous therapy participants. The first thing to note is that there was a low event rate. Secondly, if one took away esophageal candidiasis, one sees that there were only 14 events in the STI arm and 8 events, i.e. it's esophageal candidiasis that really drove the difference between the two arms. Nonetheless, the hazard ratio was 2.73 between the two strategies, and this was statistically significant. The only other fact to draw your attention to is that there were 5 deaths in the STI arm and 4 in the continuous therapy arm, hazard ratio 1.3, which was not statistically significant. The second aspect of the study was toxicity, and looking at AEs, the primary endpoint was serious adverse events, and there was no statistically significant difference between the two strategies as far as SAEs were concerned. But another important aspect was that if you looked at AEs that resulted in modification of antiretroviral therapy, there was a statistically significant difference in favor of the STI arm. Looking at changes in CD4 count, please note that zero here really refers to the time of randomization. That's after participants had already been exposed to antiretroviral therapy. There was an increase in CD4 count in the continuous treatment arm with variation in the CD4 count in the two in the participants who were on the STI arm depending on stoppage and commencement of therapy. In conclusion, over a median follow-up of 51 weeks, the majority of STI patients were able to take antiretroviral therapy intermittently without developing WHO4 events. However, the STI strategy in DART was associated with a 2.6-fold increased rate of clinical WHO stage 4 events and cannot therefore be recommended. However, no evidence of difference in mortality between the STI and CT arms was evident. The DART study continues with its primary objective. Thank you.
We have time for one or two very quick questions. Microphone 3, please.
Emmanuel Chateau from ACTA Paris. Many people from the communities are really angry against your trial. So I want to know how many people have died since the beginning of DART trials, and how can you ensure the free choice of getting involved in the trial is respected, as contrarily to the consent form, if you leave the trial, you don't have any treatments anymore.
Thank you. I think that's a very valid concern. And indeed, one should not do a trial if one consciously realizes that there are greater number of deaths in one arm or the other, or indeed in the trial in total. This trial is carefully... Sorry, did I misunderstand your question?
Please don't interrupt. Please.
How many people, I ask? Many people died.
I said there were 5 deaths in the group that were randomized to the continuous treatment arm and 4 to the group that were randomized to the STI arm. And that is really what I'm focusing on at this particular presentation.
I asked you about the full trial.
This is what I am concentrating on at this particular juncture. The other study is still continuing, and we can give you the analysis at the appropriate time.
Okay, thank you very much. To know how many people die on your trial.
Okay, thank you, Dr. Hagim. We run out of time. It's time to go to the next paper. And the next paper will be by Dr. Ningsadsort. Sorry if I misspelled. Rapid expansion of the National Antiretroviral Treatment Program in Thailand. It's Dr. Paolo Munderi, who is presenting paper 208, Survival and Causes of Deaths 2 years after introduction of antiretroviral therapy in Africa, historical cohort comparison in TB, Uganda. Sorry about that.
Thank you. I'm presenting this work on behalf of my colleagues listed here and the DART study team. Data on effectiveness, on the effectiveness and impact of ART are essential for informing treatment delivery in Africa. There are few reports from Africa, and most of these reports are from observational ART cohorts, understandably without a comparison group. And they have mostly reported on short-term survival. Now, at the MRC site of the DART trial, we had an existing cohort where substantial clinical data on pre-ART morbidity and mortality are available. So what we're presenting here is a comparison of 2-year survival and causes of death among patients who are in a treatment trial with that in a matched pre-ART cohort. The Entebbe cohort was established in 1995. It enrolled HIV-positive adults from the community around Entebbe who consented to participate and who all received basic HIV care through a clinic that's supported by the MRC. The DART trial started enrolling at this site in February 2003, and it was then that free therapy was available for the majority of these patients. As shown in these two tables, the follow-up procedures are broadly similar in the two groups, even though slightly more frequent in DART, particularly in relation to the regular recording of clinical events. So for this comparison and this analysis, we have selected a calendar period within the Entebbe cohort database during which no ART was available. This is a period from October 1995 to December 2000. And during this time, 516 subjects who would have fulfilled entry criteria for the DART trial were enrolled into the Entebbe cohort. And this translates to 658 person years of follow-up. And these are compared with 1,015 patients who were enrolled into DART over 2 years, representing 1,819 person years of follow-up. I'd like to note that 6 patients contribute time at risk to both cohorts and are actually included in the analysis. Looking at the baseline characteristics of the two groups, two-thirds of the patients in both groups are female. The pre-ART cohort was slightly younger with a mean age of 31 years. And also had a larger proportion of patients in the lower CD4 category. Numbers of death. 62 deaths have occurred in the DART trial at the Entebbe site. However, 380 deaths had occurred in the pre-ART cohort over the period of observations. Approximately half the deaths in both groups occurred in people with a CD4 below 50 category. And this table shows the computation of the mortality rates. Okay, I've lost these. Sorry. Yeah, what I'm showing here is the mortality rate stratified by CD4 count at cohort entry. Overall, we have a 17-fold reduction in mortality rate post-ART compared to pre-ART, and there are significant differences across all the CD4 groups. And these are the Kaplan-Meier survival curves showing the difference in survival between the two groups. At 1 year, there's 94% survival. At 2 years, there's 94% survival in the DART trial compared to about 28% in the pre-ART cohort. And survival is clearly related to CD4 count at cohort entry, and these are the proportions that are animated at the bottom of the graph. I want to quickly go through the causes of death. These are the absolute numbers for the different assigned causes of death, and in brackets, the cause-specific rates. And about 80% of the patients were able to assign either a specific HIV-related cause of death or a syndrome. We see that cryptococcus was the most frequent specific cause of death pre-ART. Overall, with antiretroviral therapy, there's a reduction in rates of death due to all the common opportunistic pathogens, and TB has become the most frequent diagnosis of death in DART, although HIV-related cancers and bacteremia remain relatively important. The HIV wasting syndrome, which was commonest in the pre-ART era, has virtually disappeared with ART, while the deaths not related to HIV infection have remained roughly similar. This is a historical comparison and needs to be interpreted with caution, and there are differences in the frequency of follow-up between the two cohorts. An added limitation is that the cause of death was unknown in up to 22%. At least some of this effect could have been due to improvements over time due to other causes, and the observed impact is in a clinical research setting where we have reinforced follow-up of patients and very good adherence to treatment. But in spite of these limitations, I feel that we can draw the following conclusions. The simple first-line ART therapy that we use is highly effective. 2 years survival on ART is 94%, and there's an overall reduction in mortality 17 times. There's significant survival benefit as well when treatment is initiated at very low CD4 counts. Reductions in death associated with common opportunistic pathogens have been noted, and the HIV wasting syndrome has disappeared. However, we note that TB and HIV-related cancers and bacteremia remain important in the ART era, but we do believe that these data highlight the impact that therapy can have on AIDS and death in Uganda. Thank you.
Thank you, Paula. We have time for a couple of questions. Microphone two. No, I'm sorry. Microphone three.
Not a question, but a comment. It's too bad that that group didn't stick around to hear the good work that's coming out of the DART trial.
Any further question? No, thank you. Now we go to the next paper, Rapid Expansion of the National Antiretroviral Treatment Program in Thailand, Program Outcomes and Patient Survival, 2000 to 2005. And the presenter will be Dr. Lert Piri Yasuwat. Sorry if I misspelled.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Good morning, everyone. I'm very happy to share with all of you today about our experience on antiretroviral viral treatment program and treatment outcome in Thailand. Thailand National Antiretroviral Program initiated in 2000, the year 2000, and rapidly expand access nationwide to 2004 and up to now in 2006, with the free ARV CD4 testing and basic laboratory for monitoring. Our criteria to starting the ARV on HIV patient with CD4 below to 250 and sorry, 250 and the first regimen in Thailand is combinations between D4T3TC and nivolumab, so-called the TPOVR, which is generic drug produced by government pharmaceutical organization in Thailand. This slide shows increasing access to the ARV by PLHA in our country. We start with a very small number in the year 2001, and in that time, it's also very limited the site for ARV. I'd like to note that this figure is just only free ARV scheme. We also have another scheme, such as the social security insurance and private insurance, which make cumulative case more than 100,000 in this moment. The method, we collect the data from electronic patient record during the January 2000 to March 2005 and reported from the 746 sites throughout our country, and it is a centralized system. Around 42,000 patients visit to the government hospital before March 2005. You will see small numbers of cases enrolled before 2003, and 1,000 of cases enrolled in 2003 and 2004, and still keep that momentum until now. As I showed you in the graph earlier, the median follow-up time is 7.5 months. The median age at enrollment is 34 years, 52% was male. Baseline CD4 cell count is quite low. It's 46 cells. Half of them is defining illness. 90% use nivolumab base, and 83% was naive patients. This slide will show the emergical result in ARV patient. We divide into the three cohort. The first one were follow up until the first one follow up until the 12 month, but I don't know why this not work. Okay, but it's coming. And second one is follow up. Until the 18 month, and the third one is until the 24 month. We also did a similar trend of increasing the CD4 level in those three cohorts, as you may see in this table. The slide shows the regimen change among patients with the follow-up more than 12 months. 15% change to second line, which is more costly, as you know. Change to the efferent is almost 70. Change to the efferent is almost 60%. And PI base in 32%. And other is 9%. The median follow-up time is 6.4 months. The two main reasons for ARV change are observed are adverse event and treatment failure. This slide This slide showed the 5-year follow-up. The 5-year follow-up, 15% is discontinuing treatment. The main reasons were a death, which is 42%, and a loss follow-up, which is 36%. This slide showed the hazard ratio of a death by baseline CD4 count. We divided it into four groups, as you see in the graph. And using the CD4 more than 200 cells reference group, and the survival rate was highest in this group, you will see the rapidly drop survival in 1 year, especially in first 6 months in the yellow line, which is a low CD4 baseline group, and an adjusted hazard ratio is 6.1. In the adverse event, we found the rate is 22 per 100 year with any adverse event. Mostly it's in the severe rash and the severe hepatitis. Please note that this figure is mostly represent only severe adverse event condition. In the conclusion, we found a significant improvement of CD4 cells among patients adhere to ARV. Most patients have been maintained on the first line regimen, which is called TPOV. Early ART initiation was associated with a reduced mortality. And last but not least, to reduce the rate in the first 6 months, the program effort should promote early identification of HIV infection and early access to treatments such as VCT and CD4 count monitoring. I would like to acknowledge Department of Disease Control, Family and Public Health, Provincial Health Office, and Global AIDS Program in Thailand and in Atlanta, and special thanks for PRHA in Thailand. Thank you.
We have time for questions. No questions?
Okay, thank you. And I'd like to thank very much the first half of the speakers for their presentations. We'll take a brief pause and we will ask the second set of speakers to come to the podium. I would also like to introduce the next two chairs for the next session. First is Dr. Eli Katafera, who comes from Uganda. Eli is one of the co-chairs of this year's World AIDS Conference. The other co-chair for this half of the session is Andy Zalopa, who comes to us from the United States. So we will get started very shortly. I thank everyone so far.
Okay. Hard wink? Hard winking?
And hard wink. It's in that.
Okay. Oh, it's okay. That's me. Yeah. He'll do the first four.
I do five, four, and that's five.
Yeah. Okay. Hi. None of it. I think we'll be all right, yeah. I think we should roll.
Yeah.
Well, let's
start with our second phase. Once again, I would like to thank you for sacrificing your lunch break and be with us. But I think you all agree with me, these are important presentations on this occasion. Our next speaker is Dr. Gandhi, and is giving his presentation on high prevalence and mortality from extensively drug-resistant TB in TB HIV co-infected patients in rural South Africa.
Good afternoon. The HIV and tuberculosis epidemics in South Africa are closely intertwined. Roughly 80% of all active TB cases in the province of KwaZulu-Natal are co-infected with HIV. The annual mortality rate among co-infected patients was nearly 40% before the availability of antiretroviral medications. We were able to reduce the mortality rate to 12% in our TB-ARV integration study in KwaZulu-Natal. Of note, though, 71% of the deaths in our study were due to multidrug-resistant or MDR-TB. The last drug-resistant survey in KwaZulu-Natal was performed in 2002. It found an MDR prevalence of 1.7% among new TB cases. In contrast, in our TB-ARV integration study, 9.1% of new TB cases were found to have MDR-TB. Additionally, 6 out of the 10 MDR patients in our study had resistance to all first and second line drugs tested. A recent report described the presence of TB strains which are resistant not only to isoniazid and rifampicin, but also second-line TB medications. They referred to these isolates as extensively drug-resistant, or XDR-TB. A total of 347 XDR-TB isolates were identified throughout the world. Few data, however, were available regarding the presence of XDR-TB in Africa and in high HIV prevalence settings. Therefore, the objectives of our study were to determine the extent of MDR-TB and XDR-TB among patients presenting to a rural district hospital in KwaZulu-Natal, South Africa. We also sought to describe patient and treatment characteristics for patients found to have XDR-TB. We performed a cross-sectional study of patients suspected of having active TB. Isolates were collected from mycobacterial culture from January 2005 to March 2006. Samples were collected in 3 stages. The first stage represented the standard of care in South Africa. Sputum samples were collected only from patients with TB treatment failure or those who were retreatment cases. We chose to expand the survey in stage 2 to all inpatients with suspected or diagnosed TB who were admitted to the TB wards. Finally, in stage 3, we collected samples from all patients who had any symptoms consistent of TB. Drug susceptibility testing for first and second line TB drugs was performed on all positive cultures. A chart review was performed for all patients found to have strains with resistance to all first and second line drugs, our XDR-TB cases. Molecular fingerprinting by spalogotyping was also performed on all XDR-TB isolates. Sputum samples were collected from a total of 1,539 patients in all 3 stages combined. 544 of these patients were found to have cultures positive for TB. Of the 544 culture positive patients, 221 were found to have resistance to both isoniazid and rifampicin, or had MDR-TB. To place this number in context, in 2004, there were a total of 128 cases of MDR-TB in the entire United States. 53 of the 221 MDR cases were resistant to all first and second line TB drugs tested, or were XDR-TB. As a comparison, there were 347 cases of XDR-TB total worldwide described in the recent CDC report. I will focus on the 53 XDR-TB patients in our study for the remainder of this talk. The median age was 35 years among the XDR-TB patients. Half were female, and unexpectedly, 79% of the XDR-TB patients were sputum smear positive. 51% of the XDR-TB patients were never treated previously for TB. Thus, XDR-TB was their first presentation for TB. Additionally, of those who were previously tested, the majority were either cured or had successful TB completion. Only 7 patients in the cohort had prior TB treatment failure or default. Given that the majority of patients were either never previously tested for TB or previously cured of TB, our data suggests that most of these patients were newly infected with the drug-resistant strains rather than having developed drug resistance on prior therapy. 64% of the patients were hospitalized for any cause before the onset of their XDR-TB. 2 healthcare workers have died of confirmed XDR-TB, and 4 others are suspected to have died from XDR-TB. Therefore, we conclude that nosocomial transmission of drug-resistant strains in the hospital is probable. Transmission in the community may, however, be possible, since 36% of the XDR-TB patients had no prior hospitalizations. 44 of the 53 patients had been tested for HIV. All of them were HIV infected. The mean CD4 count was 73. Only 15 of these patients were on antiretroviral therapy at the time of their XDR-TB illness. Molecular fingerprints for 30 of the XDR-TB patients have been performed so far. Nearly 90% of the patients were found to have strains that were genetically similar, which suggests that patients were recently infected with the drug-resistant strain. 52 of our 53 XDR-TB patients have died. The mean survival from the date of sputum collection was 16 days. No significant differences were seen based on, in survival were seen based on patient characteristics. This slide is a Kaplan-Meier curve depicting the XDR-TB patient survival from the date of sputum collection. As you can see, the vast majority of patients died within the first 30 days after sputum collection. In summary, multi-drug-resistant TB is substantially more common in a rural district of KwaZulu-Natal compared to previously published rates. In addition, an extensively resistant strain of TB accounts for nearly one quarter of all MDR-TB cases. We found that XDR-TB was likely caused by recent transmission in both the hospital and community. All patients who were tested for HIV were found to be HIV infected. This disease has been rapidly and nearly completely fatal. MDR and XDR-TB have emerged as a significant cause of death among TB-HIV co-infected patients. Initiation of the routine collection of sputum for culture and drug susceptibility testing has allowed us to identify MDR and XDR-TB as a cause of death among HIV patients. The successes achieved by ARV and TB-DOTS programs are threatened by MDR and XDR-TB. Transmission of MDR and XDR-TB must be addressed to further improve survival among HIV co-infected patients. Based on our findings, we would make the following recommendations. Routine culture of all TB suspects in high HIV prevalence settings should be implemented to determine the full extent of MDR and XDR-TB in these populations, as well as to identify MDR and XDR-TB cases as early as possible for treatment. A substantial scale-up in laboratory capacity is urgently needed to allow for such TB cultures and drug susceptibility testings in resource-limited settings. Improvements in infection control facilities and practices are necessary to prevent the transmission of drug-resistant strains. These include improving ventilation in TB wards, creating isolation facilities for suspected MDR-TB cases, and increased vigilance to identify undiagnosed TB patients. Contact tracing of all TB, MDR-TB, and XDR-TB cases is needed to allow for the immediate diagnosis or prophylaxis of any additional cases and limit the possible community spread of TB. Finally, but most importantly, further resources are necessary to strengthen TB control programs in order to ensure the adequate TB treatment completion and reduce TB mortality among HIV co-infected patients. Thank you.
Unfortunately, you run over your time, so there's no questions. So thank you, Dr. Gandhi. Our next speaker is Dr. Daniel Krzyzewski. He's a different name from what is published in your documents. And he's going to talk about if evidence-based regimens are potent in treatment-naive subjects across a wide range of pre-treatment HIV-1 RNA and CD4 cell counts. 3-year results from SDG 5095.
Thank you very much. It's my pleasure on behalf of my ACTG 5095 colleagues to present this analysis to you. I should point out that this is entirely the work of Heather Roboto, the protocol statistician who couldn't be here because of a prior family commitment. So the data are hers and any mistakes are mine. By way of background, as you know, regimens including 2-nucleoside reverse transcriptase inhibitors plus efavirenz are widely used as initial treatment for HIV-infected persons. However, concern persists about the virologic potency of this regimen among patients with advanced disease, particularly those with very high virus loads or very low CD4 cell counts. ACTG 5095 was a double-blind, randomized, placebo-controlled study of protease inhibitor-sparing regimens that included both 3- and 4-drug arms with efavirenz, as well as a triple nucleoside arm, conducted in treatment-naive HIV-infected subjects with detectable viremia at any CD4 cell count, and subjects were stratified by virus load at entry by having greater than or less than 100,000 copies per mil as their entry viremia. All subjects were intended to be followed regardless of treatment change for 96 weeks after the last subject was randomized. As you may be familiar with, there were more than 1,100 patients enrolled between March 2001 and November 2002. The triple nucleoside arm was halted by the Safety Monitoring Board in February of 2003 when the triple nucleoside regimen was found to be inferior to each of the 2 efavirenz arms, and these data have been published. More recently, we presented the follow-up of the efavirenz-containing arms, which was extended until March of 2005. And found no difference between the triple drug and quadruple drug regimen after a median of 3 years of follow-up, and these results have just recently been published. The objectives of the current analysis were to compare the effect of baseline virus load and baseline CD4 cell count on virological and immunological responses among efavirenz-treated subjects in this trial, and to assess whether adding a 3rd nucleoside reverse transcriptase inhibitor improved responses in any subgroup. Subjects were characterized into predetermined subgroups by baseline virus load and CD4 cell count. Associations of virus load and CD4 subgroups with the risk of virologic failure used Kaplan-Meier and Cox proportional hazards models, where virologic failure was defined as a confirmed virus load above 200 copies per mil. Associations with CD4 cell count increases from baseline at weeks 48, 96, and 144 used normal linear models. All analyses presented here today were intention to treat, but as treated analyses were also performed and confirmed these results. Nearly 770 subjects were enrolled into the 2 efavirenz arms with a median follow-up of 144 weeks. Almost 20% of the group were women, and more than half of the group were persons of color. You can see here by the baseline parameters that approximately a quarter of the subjects had more than 300,000 copies per mil as baseline virus load, and 20% had a CD4 count below 50. So this was quite an advanced cohort and a robust data set in which to conduct this analysis. This slide shows the Kaplan-Meier plot of time to virologic failure stratified by baseline virus load, and it's obvious there was no difference among the different entry strata when stratified by baseline viremia. When we look at the results by baseline CD4 count, curiously, there seems to be a slightly higher rate of failure among those with the highest CD4 cell count. This is explained mostly by subjects who entered with very high CD4 counts deciding later that they really preferred not to be on therapy, and the as-treated analysis actually shows no difference among the groups. This slide is the Cox proportionate hazards model of the risk of virologic failure by baseline virus load or baseline CD4 count. Here, the referenced population is the group with the highest entry virus loads above 300,000, and you can see that by comparison, there was no difference in the risk of failure for any of the other groups. In other words, no other group did any better than the group with the highest virus loads. And similarly, in the panel on the right, where the reference group is the group with the lowest CD4 cell counts, again, all the groups did similarly with respect to the risk of virologic failure. If we now compare the risk of failure in patients receiving three-drug versus four-drug regimens by stratum, again, you can see that overall there was no difference between the three- and four-drug groups, as we've reported, and there was no group difference by stratum among the various entry virus loads, and no difference by stratum among the different baseline CD4 cell counts. Turning now to the proportion of subjects who achieved a virus load of less than 50 copies per mil, you can see very nicely the splaying of these curves in terms of the time to suppression, reflecting the longer time necessary to reach less than 50 copies among the patients with the highest entry virus loads. But you see that there was really no difference in the proportion of subjects who achieved and maintained complete suppression of viremia, regardless of their entry virus load. Likewise, there was no difference in the likelihood of becoming maintaining undetectable viremia by baseline CD4 cell count. If we look at the change in CD4 cell count from baseline, you can see that those who entered with the highest levels of viremia, shown in the orange, if I can get the pointer, had the greatest CD4 cell increase, but that overall there's really no difference among the other three strata. And if we look at the increase in CD4 cell count as a function of entry CD4 cell number, these groups really look quite similar. Again, there's some noise in the highest CD4 group at entry because of the dropout in that group by patients who decided not to continue with treatment. So in conclusion, after a median of 3 years, over 80% of the subjects had virus loads less than 50 copies per mil, with a median CD4 increase of nearly 280 cells per microliter. Baseline virus load and CD4 cell count were not associated with treatment outcome. These results demonstrate the potency of efavirenz-based regimens across a wide range of CD4 cell counts and virus loads. Addition of a third nucleoside reverse transcriptase inhibitor did not enhance response in any subgroup. I'd like to acknowledge the efforts of the entire ACTG 5095 team, in particular Trip Gulick, who is our protocol chair, and of course Heather Roboto and her army of biostatisticians at the Center for Biostatistics and AIDS Research, who really did all of these analyses. I'd also like to acknowledge the support from the rest of the team and our pharmaceutical co-sponsors, from the participating AIDS clinical trials units and virology labs, and from the Division of AIDS that supported this work, as well as the patient volunteers. Thank you very much.
We have time for a few questions. Number two.
Yep. John Mellers, University of Pittsburgh. Dan, did you see any difference in the frequency of resistance mutations in the different strata of baseline parameters in those who failed?
That's a good question. We haven't analyzed those data yet.
Another question? Well, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Let's move on. Our next speaker is Dr. Grunfeld, and he's going to talk about recombinant human growth hormone to treat HIV-associated adipose adipose distribution syndrome, a 12-week induction and a 24-week maintenance therapy.
Thank you. And I'd like to thank the organizers for inviting us to present this, which is the second large study of recombinant growth hormone in HIV-associated adipose redistribution syndrome. I'm presenting on behalf of the writing group and the investigators. This study is sponsored by Serono Laboratories, and I will be presenting data both from the 12-week induction and from the 24-week maintenance therapy. HIV infection is unique in that increased visceral adipose tissue is often accompanied by subcutaneous lipoatrophy. Both of these changes in fat depots have metabolic consequences, and the two together provide what is, in essence, a double whammy. This study will focus upon those patients with increased visceral adipose tissue as determined by anthropometric entry criteria. The patients with the syndrome may exhibit dyslipidemia, insulin resistance, and glucose intolerance. They may also have dorsocervical fat pads, and the syndrome is associated by poor quality of life. Here you see the type of increased visceral fat in black on CT scan, also known as fat, in patients with the syndrome compared to healthy controls. They're also likely to have less subcutaneous fat in the abdomen than healthy controls, and certainly have less leg fat. The study is a phase 3 randomized double-blind placebo-controlled trial. The induction phase lasted 12 weeks, in which patients were randomized to growth hormone, 4 milligrams daily dose, which is abbreviated DD, in 3-to-1 ratio to those who received placebo. The pre-specified efficacy endpoint for the induction phase was reduction of VAT at 12 weeks of growth hormone versus placebo. Those on growth hormone were then randomized in a maintenance phase over the next 24 weeks to out to 36 weeks. Half received growth hormone at 2 milligrams alternate day dosing, abbreviated AD, and half received placebo and alternate day dosing. Those on placebo eventually were given a similar growth hormone induction, and the results are similar to this arm but will not be presented today, and we also not present the extension study. During the maintenance phase, the pre-specified endpoint was that those receiving growth hormone less than 50% of them would regain more than 50% of the visceral adipose tissue that they lost in the induction phase. The eligibility criteria included documented HIV infection on stable antiretroviral therapy. Excess visceral adipose tissue was determined by anthropometric criteria, which included both an increase in waist circumference and an increase in waist-to-hip ratio, with the numbers varying appropriately between men and women. Patients with diabetes were pre-excluded. Lipid-lowering drugs were allowed, although had to be stable. And we performed the glucose tolerance test at entry and accepted into the study only those who had a fasting glucose of less than 110 or a two-hour glucose of less than 140, so we excluded after a 75-gram glucose load, so we excluded impaired glucose tolerance. The primary endpoint of the trial was change in visceral fat at week 12. We had key secondary endpoints, including trunk fat on DEXA, fasting lipid profile, and as I mentioned, the maintenance of reduced VAT during the maintenance phase. The baseline characteristics of the placebo group and the growth hormone receiving group were very similar. The highlights were the fact that we had about 15% females, the CD4 count averaged about 500, the visceral adipose tissue area was 135 centimeters squared. The only statistically significant difference was the percentage of use of NRTI. However, virtually everyone in the study was on NRTI, with 93% in the growth hormone wing and 100% in the placebo wing. This shows the results of several key primary and secondary endpoints. In these slides, placebo will be on the left, growth hormone will be on the right. The primary endpoint was a reduction in visceral adipose tissue, and you can see that there was a more than 20% reduction of visceral adipose tissue from baseline to week 12 in the induction phase, which was statistically significantly different than those in placebo who tended to gain visceral fat. This was paralleled by a decrease in trunk fat on DEXA, on growth hormone, versus placebo. The loss in limb fat was much less on growth hormone compared to the loss in trunk fat. Likewise, the loss in adipose tissue, subcutaneous fat on CT scan, was less than the loss of visceral adipose tissue. Here are the cholesterol profiles in baseline to week 12. Non-HDL cholesterol, a key atherogenic lipoprotein in patients with HIV infection, was significantly reduced by growth hormone, and this was highly different from placebo, which did not change. LDL cholesterol dropped in both groups, and there was no difference between the two groups. HDL cholesterol, or good cholesterol, went up slightly in those in growth hormone, and that was significantly different than those on placebo. Patients who entered the study who were dyslipidemic had the greatest changes, favorable changes, in the greatest decrease both in non-HDL cholesterol and increase in HDL cholesterol. During maintenance therapy, the maintenance dose did meet the goal of less than 50% regain. The numbers, however, were 40% of those on growth hormone maintenance regained more than 50%. Placebo failed, 54% regained more than 50% of the fat lost. Now, the predetermined criteria focused on those who lost visceral adipose tissue, and that represented 85% of those on growth hormone. In terms of all patients in an intent to treat, there was still a 15-centimeter loss in growth hormone maintenance. Those on placebo also had a small change, and these two were not statistically different from each other. If you looked at the pre-specified endpoint of those who lost while on growth hormone, the decrease at the end of the maintenance was even larger, at 27 centimeters squared. Those who got placebo were still down 10 centimeters squared from baseline. And again, the difference between these two arms was not statistically significant. The safety profile is shown here just for those who received growth hormone. So it included those who got growth hormone induction and growth hormone maintenance, which is shown in blue, and those who got growth hormone induction and placebo, shown in red. There was no significant difference over the course of study in CD4 counts. IGF-1 levels went up as expected during the induction therapy to the levels that we would anticipate from previous studies in of growth hormone. Those on placebo dropped back to normal, and those who were on the maintenance dose had lower levels consistent with the maintenance dose therapy. There was a transient increase in mean fasting glucose at week 2, and this was already tapering over the course of the 12-week induction therapy, consistent with data from previous studies showing only transient insulin resistance, and it returned to normal during the growth hormone maintenance therapy with no difference compared to placebo, and a slightly parallel change was seen in insulin resistance, insulin area under the curve during a GTT at 12 weeks and at subsequent weeks. The most common adverse events were those that might be anticipated from growth hormone from previous studies, including peripheral edema, arthralgias, extremity pain, headache, hyperesthesia, myalgia, and increase in blood glucose. More than 95% of the events were deemed mild and moderate. There was no significant difference in serious adverse events between the arms of placebo versus growth hormone during induction, and virtually all of the serious adverse events were not considered to even be possibly related to the drug. I will point out that some of the patients developed hyperglycemia and had either dose reduction or discontinuations in the placebo arm, although more occurred in the growth hormone arm, indicating the propensity for both HIV and growth hormone to lead to increases in glucose. during the maintenance phase, and again, these are just the patients who received growth hormone, the prevalence of side effects was much lower, and there was no difference between the two arms. Again, more than 95% of the side effects were mild to moderate, and no difference in serious adverse events. Therefore, in conclusion, induction therapy with growth hormone 4 milligrams a day led to a significant reduction in visceral adipose tissue, a reduction in trunk fat, an improvement in cholesterol profile versus placebo. Maintenance therapy met the predefined goal of fewer than 50% on growth hormone, regaining more than 50% of that loss during induction, improvement in the cholesterol profile. The safety profile was as anticipated with adverse events, mostly mild to moderate. There was greater loss of fat and trunk fat than abdominal fat and limb fat, with transient increases in glucose and related parameters. I wish to thank the investigators, the principal investigators, the study participants, and all of the study personnel.
Thank you very much. Unfortunately, the presentation went over time, so there won't be questions. Thank you very much. Our next speaker is Dr. Ramadan, and his presentation is on predictors of virological failure and HIV resistance among patients receiving fixed-dose combination stavudine, lamivudine, and verapine in northern Tanzania.
Thank you. Good afternoon. I would like to discuss a third goal, the predictors of virologic failure and HIV drug resistance among patients receiving fixed-dose combination of stavudine, lamivudine, nevirapine in northern Tanzania. I'm presenting on behalf of my co-authors at Kilimanjaro Christian Medical Center in Moshi, Tanzania, and at Duke University. By the way of background, ART access is expanding rapidly in Africa, and provision of free ART in Tanzania was announced in September 2004, beginning at consultant referral hospitals. However, before this time, and during the transition period to free therapy, some patients paid for ART and were included in this retrospective study. Early ART program focus has been on targets of number of persons on therapy, and a few data are available on the prevalence and the risk factors for virologic failure and resistance, which are indicators of the good quality of the treatment programs. Yet, such information is needed to optimize ART program in sub-Saharan Africa. Consequently, the aim of this study were to determine the extent and the risk factors for virologic failure in Tanzanian cohort, and to describe genotypic resistance mutation and the risk factors for resistance in patients failing therapy. To investigate these questions, we designed a retrospective cohort study of 150 HIV infected adult patients evaluated between June and August 2005, who had received a fixed-dose combination of stavudine, lamivudine, and nevirapine for 6 months or more. We enrolled consecutive patients presenting for routine follow-up at the Kilimanjaro Christian Medical Center Adult Infectious Disease Clinic, and a standardized questionnaire was developed and administered for all patients that included questions on socio-demographic, economic conditions, HIV, and ART knowledge, beliefs, disclosure, adherence, and access to care. Plasma was obtained from patients for HIV RNA quantitation using the Roche Ampico 1.5 assay and for HIV genotypic resistance testing. For the purpose of this study, virologic failure was defined as HIV RNA 400 copies per mil or more, and the drug resistance was defined as one or more major NRTI or NNRTI mutations using the mutation figures of the IAS USA November 2000 revision. I would now like to present the findings on the evaluation of the prevalence and the risk factors for virologic failure and resistance in this cohort. Among 150 patients enrolled, 94 or 63% were female, and the median age was 41 years. The median CD4 count at ART initiation was 113 cells. The median duration on ART was 12 months, and 23 or 16% of subjects reported adherence less than 100%. This slide summarizes the results of laboratory evaluation for virologic failure. Of 150 study subjects, 48 or 32% were found to be experiencing virologic failure. Statistically significant risk factors for virologic failure on bivariable analysis are shown in black, and these included the proportion of months on ART that were self-funded rather than provided for free, and disclosure of HIV zero status to other person, to persons other than the clinic staff was protective against virologic failure. A number of factors were not found. A number of factors were not found to be associated with virologic failure and are shown in gray. On multivariable logistic regression analysis, virologic failure remained to be associated with the proportion of months on ART that were self-funded, and disclosure of HIV serostatus to persons other than the clinic staff remained to be protective against virologic failure. To understand how self-funded ART is associated with virologic failure, we undertook further analysis. And we showed that persons who paid for ART were more likely to be maladherent. The correlation coefficient was 0.54 and the p-value was less than 0.01. Therefore, self-funded ART was associated with maladherence, in which in turn led to increased risk factor for, virologic failure. Let's now move to HIV-1 subtyping and HIV genotypic resistance results. Now, turning to genotypic resistance findings, as I mentioned earlier, of 150 study subjects, 48 or 32% were found to be experiencing virologic failure. Of these, genotyping was attempted from 35 subjects who had HIV RNA concentration of 1,000 copies or more. Of these, 27 or 77% could be sequenced, and of those sequenced, 15 were found to have one or more major resistance mutation. This slide summarizes genotypic resistance finding of those with at least one major mutation. Genotypic resistance mutation fell into well-recognized groups seen commonly among patients receiving NNRTI-based triple drug regime. As you can see in the first row, 13% of patients had just one mutation, and these were common NNRTI mutations. In the second row, 47% of patients had two mutations. All had NRTI mutation, M184V, and a mixture of NNRTI mutations. In the third row, 40% of patients had three or more mutations. Most of these patients had M184V or I mutations. All had NNRTI mutations, and most had thymidine analog mutations, or the Q151M multi-drug resistance mutation. This slide shows the results of bivariable analysis looking at the risk factors for the presence of one or more major resistance mutation. The only factor associated with the presence of one or more major resistance mutation was CD4 count below the median at the time of ART initiation. In conclusion, 1/3 of adult patients who had been taking ART for 6 months or more in this study were experiencing virologic failure. And patients who paid for ART were at risk for aortic failure mediated by maladherence, presumably due to inability to consistently pay for therapy, and disclosure of HIV status, a likely marker of social coping with the diagnosis, was protective against virologic failure, and the presence of resistance mutation was associated with low CD4 positive T lymphocyte count at the treatment initiation, possibly mediated by higher HIV RNA concentration at ART initiation. We believe that these data allow us to make several recommendations. First, it is important that efforts are made to continue to provide free ART and to promote social coping to enhance adherence, to enhance and to limit the occurrence of aortic failure. Second, we need to redouble efforts to encourage early detection of persons with HIV infection. Such efforts might include wider availability of voluntary counseling and testing, and encouraging the offer of more routine HIV testing, even to people who do not feel ill. Finally, we found that this Sentinel site HIV RNA contention resistance study to be useful to evaluate an ART program, to understand how to optimize ART in our setting, and to identify treatment failure early in a group of patients. In addition to my co-author, I would like to acknowledge the many people at KCMC, Kiwakuki, and at Duke, and elsewhere who make this clinical research possible. I would also like to acknowledge the support from the U.S. National Institute of Health, particularly through the Duke Center for AIDS Research and the AIDS International Training and Research Program from the Fogart Center, which respectively funded this study and my training. Thank you for your attention.
Thank you very much again. Once again, you've run over your time, so you won't be time for questions. We'll take this opportunity to change over responsibility. I would like now to hand over to my co-chair, Dr. Andrew Zolof.
Thank you. We're in the final stretch of the marathon, and like most marathons, these last few miles are the toughest, but they can be the most rewarding. I think you'll find the next five presentations quite rewarding. It's my pleasure to introduce to you Professor Martin Markowitz from the Aaron Diamond in New York, presenting a paper entitled Potent Antiretroviral Effect of MK0518, a Novel HIV Integrase Inhibitor as Part of Combination ART in Treatment-Naive HIV-1-Infected Patients. Marty.
Thanks, Andy. A little difficult to hear up here. Thank you for allowing us to present these data today. I'm honored to present on behalf of 28 co-investigators on four continents and the Merck Research Laboratory Development Team. MK518 is a novel strand transfer inhibitor of HIV integrase. It has potent in vitro activity with an IC95 of 33 nanomolar in the presence of 50% human serum. Its metabolism is via the liver, via glucuronidation. It is not a CYP3A4 substrate and is therefore not a candidate for ritonavir boosting. Phase 1 study supported BID dosing, doses of 100 to 800 milligrams twice daily, and note that the 100 milligram twice daily dose has a trough level that exceeds the IC95. The drug does not require dose adjustments with other antiretroviral study to date. Protocol 004 had a rather unique study design. 40 patients were entered into the monotherapy phase where four doses of MK518, 100, 200, 400 and 600 milligrams twice daily was compared to placebo. After the data was collected, there was an interim analysis of the data supporting moving all doses into the second phase, where an additional 150 patients were recruited and randomized to receive tenofovir 3TC in combination with one of the doses of MK518, with efavirenz 600 milligrams once daily being the comparator. Key inclusion criteria included susceptibility to efavirenz 3TC and tenofovir by genotype. Patients were drug naive, had viral loads greater than 5,000, and CD4 cell counts greater than 100 cells per millimeter cubed. Endpoints were typical viral load, CD4, and safety. Baseline characteristics were balanced across study arms. Patients on average were in their mid-30s, generally male, non-white, with viral loads approximately 4.8 log. CD4s were approximately 300 or a bit more, and about 30 to 40% of the cohorts had an AIDS diagnosis. This is the patient status at 24 weeks. You can see that the drug was extremely well tolerated with very few dropouts. There were a total of 10 dropouts, two in the 200 milligram arm due to lack of efficacy, and one in the 600 milligram arm due to adverse events. The rest of the dropouts were due to administrative issues. This is the delta viral load using the 400 copy assay. As you can see, all arms had a precipitous drop in viral load over the first couple of weeks with a slower decay during the subsequent weeks. And at 24 weeks, there was approximately a 2.5 log reduction in viral load across study arms. Looking at the percent of patients who go below 400 copies per ml, non-complete or equal failure, you can see that all the doses of MK-518 as well as efavirenz by week 24 reach a viral load less than 400 in more than 90% of the cases, and there's no difference between the arms. However, interestingly, in looking at the rate at which patients go to undetectable levels, the MK-518 using the less than 50 copy assay, non-complete or equal failure, in all MK-518 study arms, the rate at which patients go to undetectable is more rapid than the efavirenz arm, and this is statistically significantly different at both weeks 4 and 8. However, by week 24, 85 to 95% of the patients have viral loads less than 50, and there's no difference between study arms. Accompanying the virologic response was an immunologic response of approximately 100 to 150 cells across study arms, no difference between them. The drug was well tolerated, and for sake of simplicity, we're presenting all the doses of MK-518 in one column and the efavirenz arm in the other column. In the 160 patients who were exposed to study drug, patients experienced nausea, headache, dizziness, diarrhea, insomnia, and abnormal dreams. You can see the relative percentage of these occurring in the efavirenz arm. As far as safety, most clinical adverse events were mild to moderate. There were 8 serious adverse events in the study overall. However, none were considered due to drug. There was one patient who discontinued drug for increased liver function tests, and other grade 3 and 4 laboratory abnormalities were uncommon, and none resulted in drug discontinuation. In conclusion, MK-518 is a new strand transfer inhibitor of HIV integrase with potent antiviral activity in treatment-naive patients with viral loads above 5,000 and CD4 cell counts below 100. At all doses studied at 24 weeks, the drug showed potent antiviral activity in combination. 85 to 95% of the patients had viral loads below 50, and it's important to note that suppression was achieved faster as compared to the efavirenz arm, and in general, the drug was well tolerated. Thank you.
Okay, we have time for questions. Can I just ask, Marty, do you think that the more rapid decline to less than 50...
I can't hear.
The more rapid decline to less than 50 in the integrase inhibitor, does that reflect differences in potency?
The difference in the rate at which patients go to undetectable is as yet unexplained, and it requires further study. It might be pharmacokinetic. It might also reflect differences in potency. The fact that there were differences at week 4 and 8 even suggests perhaps that there's an effect on the second phase that needs to be further studied.
Good. Microphone number 3, please.
Colleen Cunningham, Duke. If I understand it correctly, you had individuals that were on the monotherapy phase that then rolled over to the second phase. Did those patients have any kind of different response to treatment compared to the ones that just started off on triple combination?
No, those patients did not have a difference, and the two patients who failed virologically were patients who were started on triple therapy.
Okay, microphone number 3.
Hi, John Newman, Merrill Lynch, New York. The patient that discontinued the study due to the adverse event related to the liver, how long was he in the study? Did he reach the end, or
You know, the patient did not reach the end of the study. The liver function test abnormalities appeared at approximately week 4, I believe. It's important to note the patient had been on INH therapy chronically or stably. The LFTs went up. The drug was stopped. Patient was rechallenged. The LFTs abnormalities recurred, and the patient was discontinued from study, I believe, at approximately week 8.
Thank you.
Okay, last question, number 3, Jerry.
Thank you, Marty. Since all of the dosages were equivalent, essentially, what dose are you going to recommend to go forward?
Well, I'm not in the position of recommending doses. However, I can.
Will be recommended.
However, I can tell you that the 400 milligram twice daily dose has been taken forward in the extension of this study to the 96-week point, and also in the phase 3 studies, which are using 400 BID in experienced patients.
Okay, thank you, Marty. Our next paper will be presented by Dr. Howard Meyer from Pfizer, the title Safety and Efficacy of Maraviroc, a Novel CCR5 Antagonist When Used in Combination with Optimized Background Therapy for the Treatment of Antiretroviral Experienced Subjects Infected with Dual Mixtropic HIV-1, 24-week results of a Phase 2B exploratory trial. I think I took about half your time just to read the title.
Good afternoon. It's my pleasure to present the 24-week results of study A400-1029, which evaluated the safety and efficacy of maraviroc when used in combination with optimized therapy for the treatment of antiretroviral experienced subjects infected with dual or mixtropic HIV. Maraviroc is a selective reversible CCR5 antagonist. It is active in vitro against R5 trophic HIV-1, including strains that are multi-drug resistant, but it's not active in vitro against exportrophic or R5 exportrophic HIV-1. It has nanomolar activity against both clade B and non-clade B virus, and in phase 1 and 2A clinical trials, it's been generally well tolerated in both healthy volunteers and in patients, and maximum viral load reductions of at least 1 log was observed in all patients with R5 trophic HIV-1 treated with maraviroc as monotherapy at doses of 100 milligrams twice a day or more. The activity of maraviroc in vitro and in short-term monotherapy in R5 infection led us to design a phase 2B3 clinical development program to assess the safety and efficacy of maraviroc in patients with R5 trophic HIV-1. There are 3 studies currently in phase 3 clinical development, 2 studies in treatment-experienced patients, and 1 study in treatment-naive patients. Nearly 2,000 patients have enrolled in this program. These studies are closed to further enrollment and are ongoing. The rationale for studying maraviroc in patients with dual or mixtropic infections stems from the theoretical risk of outgrowth of exportrophic virus when a patient with dual or mixtropic HIV-1 is treated with a CCR5 antagonist. As you know, exportrophic HIV-1 has been associated with more rapid CD4 cell depletion and progression to AIDS. The single patient that was enrolled in our monotherapy program that had dual or mixtropic virus by the monogram co-receptor tropism assay at screening had no overall change in their viral load, but an apparent suppression of the R5 component of their infection with expansion of the X4 component of their infection with a reversion back to a predominantly R5 infection after study drug was discontinued. On this basis, we designed a phase 2B pilot study specifically to evaluate the safety of maraviroc in patients with non-CCR5 trophic HIV-1. Following a 4 to 6 week screening and randomization period, patients who were failing and on a stable regimen received optimized background therapy, which consisted of 3 to 6 antiretroviral agents selected on the basis of genotype and phenotype, and in addition, either maraviroc once a day, maraviroc twice a day, or placebo. This is a 48-week study with a 24-week primary efficacy endpoint. The study was randomized, double-blind, placebo-controlled, and the eligibility criteria include dual or mixtropic, X4 tropic, or indeterminate tropism phenotype by the monogram co-receptor tropism assay at the time of screening. Patients were also required to be antiretroviral experienced with at least 3 months of experience with 3 classes and or dual class resistance. Patients were also to have at least 1 active drug included as part of optimized therapy, either an NNRTI, a PI, or enfuvirtide. The study population consisted of 190 randomized patients, and 186 patients were treated with at least one dose of study drug. The mean age was roughly in the low 40s and was comparable between treatment groups. 10 to 15% of the patients were women, 20 to 30% non-white, and overwhelmingly, this was a dual or mixed tropic population, with 58 patients in the placebo group, 57 in the once-a-day Maraviroc group, and 52 in the Maraviroc BID group, and this represented the primary population. With regard to optimized background therapy that was selected, more than 90% of patients in each treatment group received a protease inhibitor as part of optimized therapy, and between 50 to 60% of patients received enfuvertide as part of optimized therapy. The number of active drugs was calculated as a composite of genotypic and phenotypic susceptibility score, and in terms of the patients that had none or one active drugs as part of optimized therapy, there were more patients in the Maraviroc QD arm, 36.8%, that had zero or one active drug versus 23.1% in the Maraviroc twice-a-day arm. There were four patients in this study that had more than four active drugs, and all of those patients were in the Maraviroc twice-a-day arm. This was a very advanced HIV-infected patient population. The median CD4 count was approximately 40 in each of the treatment groups, and the mean and median viral loads were in excess of 5 logs in all treatment groups. Here are the efficacy results. The primary endpoint for the study was the mean change from baseline to week 24 in HIV-1 RNA, with discontinuers imputed as zero. The results were comparable between the placebo groups and the Maraviroc QD group, minus 0.97 and minus 0.91 log copies per ml, respectively, and slightly but not significantly greater, minus 1.2 log copies per ml in the Maraviroc twice-a-day group. So neither Maraviroc arm met the criteria for virologic superiority over placebo. With regard to some of the secondary efficacy endpoints, the percentage of patients that achieved a viral load of less than 400 copies per ml were comparable, 24.1% and 24.6% in the placebo and Maraviroc QD arms, and slightly greater, 30.8% in the Maraviroc BID arm. The percentage of patients that achieved a viral load of less than 50 copies per ml was greater in both Maraviroc arms and greatest in the Maraviroc BID arm than in the placebo arm. And finally, the mean decrease in viral load from baseline to week 24 in the patients who received enfuvertide as part of optimized therapy was also greater in both Maraviroc treatment arms than in the placebo arm. We also looked at changes in absolute CD4 count from baseline to week 24. There were increases in CD4 count that were greater in both Maraviroc treatment groups than in the placebo group, plus 60 in the Maraviroc QD group, plus 62 in the Maraviroc BID group, and plus 36 in the placebo group. We did not see these effects consistently for percentage CD4 cells. We also evaluated patients who only had CXCR tropic virus at the detectable by the monogram coreceptor tropism assay at the time of virological failure, and this was substantially more likely to happen in both Maraviroc treatment groups than in the placebo group. This occurred in 12 patients in each of the two Maraviroc treatment groups and in only 2 patients in the placebo group. And even in these patients with CXCR4 tropic virus at the time of failure, there were increases in absolute CD4 count in both Maraviroc treatment groups as opposed to the 2 patients in the placebo group who had declines in their CD4 count with a mean of minus 104. In general, Maraviroc was very well tolerated. Adverse events, including those judged to be severe or life-threatening, serious adverse events, as well as discontinuations due to adverse events, were evenly balanced between treatment groups. Importantly, there were no cases of lymphoma or adenocarcinoma reported in this study. 13 Category C events occurred, 7 in the Maraviroc QD arm, 3 in the Maraviroc BID arm, and 3 in the placebo arm. And there were 7 deaths in patients on study drug, and none of them were considered to be drug-related. 2 in the Maraviroc QD arm, 2 in the Maraviroc BID arm, and 3 in the placebo arm. With regard to high-grade liver enzyme abnormalities, there were no grade 3 or 4 ALT abnormalities in the high-dose Maraviroc group, 1 in the Maraviroc QD group, and 3 in the placebo group. abnormalities in AST were similarly distributed between treatment groups, and abnormalities in total bilirubin were also evenly distributed and were more often than not related to azathioprine use as part of optimized therapy. So in summary, over the 24 weeks of this study, in treatment-experienced patients with advanced disease and dual or mixtopic virus, maraviroc in combination with optimized background therapy was generally well-tolerated. There were no cases of hepatotoxicity, lymphoma, or adenocarcinoma. As one might have anticipated, in a dual or mixtopic population, maraviroc in combination with optimized therapy did not demonstrate superior reductions in viral load compared with placebo plus optimized background therapy. Somewhat surprisingly, maraviroc plus optimized background therapy was associated with greater increases in absolute CD4 count than the placebo plus optimized background therapy, and this needs to be explored further. Finally, patients who received maraviroc plus optimized therapy were more likely to fail with CXCR4 tropic virus than those patients who received placebo. However, patients who were treated with maraviroc and who had X4 tropic virus at the time of virological failure had increases in absolute CD4 count that was consistent with what occurred in the overall maraviroc-treated population. I would like to acknowledge first and foremost the patients who participated in this trial, the investigators and study site staff in A400-1029, colleagues from Monogram Biosciences, colleagues from Pfizer on the maraviroc team, and the other authors on this paper. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Howie. That's intriguing results. Unfortunately, we have to move on. We don't have time for questions. The next paper will be presented by Professor Pedro Kahn. It's entitled, A Phase 1 Study to Explore the Safety, Tolerability, and Pharmacokinetics of Fosalbumin Tidoxal in Patients Infected with HIV-1.
Thank you very much. It's my pleasure to present this paper on behalf of my co-workers. This paper is regarding a new drug, fosalbumin tidoxal, which is a drug that is covalently linked to a lipid moiety. And this is further processed by cellular enzymes to generate the active metabolite, the triphosphate form. This drug has a parent compound, LFT, that has been previously tested, showing good activity at high but not at low doses, as you can see in the slide, and some liver toxicity and hematologic toxicity precluded further development of this compound. This new compound, fosalbumin tidoxal, showed good antiretroviral activity at well-tolerated doses in macaques, and with the dosing that was equivalent to 150 milligrams in humans, much higher than previously used with the other compound. So this raised possible advantages like less toxicity due to less bone marrow distribution, and also some data from the animal study showed that the possibility that this drug could be used once daily. So the aim of the study was to evaluate safety, tolerability, and pharmacokinetics of fosalbumin tidoxal in HIV-1 infected patients. The study was the first time in humans, single dose, open label, developed in our hospital, in which we included 24 antiretroviral naive patients in four consecutive groups. We started with a first group of six patients in 5 milligrams and so on until we reached the 40 milligram group. Safety and tolerability was censored over the 7 days follow-up, and we also performed 72 hours pharmacokinetics. You can see here the baseline characteristics that were comparable in the four dose groups. We had 15 males and 9 males. Median body mass index, was 24.1. And viral load as per requirement for the protocol, since patients to be included need to be naive and not need treatment for their own benefit, had to be between 5,000 and 100,000 copies. And CD4 was medium around 430, with a minimum of 255, which was the threshold to be included, 250, and a maximum of 1,158.
Regarding safety and tolerability, in this one dose study, we couldn't identify any clinical significant adverse event, neither in regards to spontaneous report nor to due to physical examination or ECT. And all the hematology and biochemistry lab values remained between normal levels. Regarding the adverse events that we were able to identify, you can see here in the table a total of 8 adverse events in 8 patients occurred after drug intake. Were 2 ACTG grade 2 and 6 ACTG grade 1 events, but only 3 out of them were could be linked as probable or possible related to drug intake, and in 3 cases there was a mild headache. Regarding the pharmacokinetics, as you can see here, the mean termination half-life was between 5 and 7 hours, and Cmax is reached between 6 and 7 hours after drug intake. Of note, you can see here that no major differences were seen when you compare the 5 milligram to the 10 milligram dose, but then it seems to have a dose response curve. Continuing with the PK analysis, I would like to stress that the Cmax increases from a median around 60 microgram per liter in the lower doses to almost 500 milligrams in the 40 milligram group. And the AUC increases about 10 times from around 400 in the 5 milligram group to almost 4,000 microgram per liter in the 40 milligram group. And this increase seems to be dose proportional over the investigated dose range. In conclusion, a single dose of 5 to 40 milligrams for salvolding thyroxyl appears to be safe and well tolerated, showed a linear dose relationship with the AUC and the Cmax. The terminal half-life, around 4 to 7 hours, may allow once daily dosing, and as per the observed PK parameters, accumulation should probably not be expected. And now a dose-finding study, including once-daily administration over 14 days, exploring the same doses, has just started. Thank you very much. And I would like to acknowledge, I'm sorry, could you go back, please? Because I would like to show the acknowledgments for people that help in this study, particularly people that work with me at Fundación Huésped and Hospital Fernández, San Agustín, Marianne Figueroa, and the residents of the Fernandez Hospital. Thank you very much.
Thank you for that cogent presentation. It's open now for questions. We have a couple of minutes. Microphone number 2. There seems to be a competition for it.
Yeah, Joe and I can fight about it. Charlie Vanderhorst from University of North Carolina. I actually was part of that study with Charlie Flexner, and the death, the drug was stopped at our institution because of a death of a young physician with a high CD4 count, and we were carefully monitoring. That was a therapeutic drug monitoring trial. So there was no accumulation of dose in that person, and he died of hepatic necrosis, which we had autopsy and showed drug toxicity. So there is, of course, with accumulation, the problem of the hematologic toxicity, but I don't know that you're going to avoid a idiosyncratic hepatotoxicity. So, as I would say, be very careful.
We will for sure.
Thank you, Charlie. Joe?
Yeah, just a quick question. With the single dose, were you able to get some viral load data?
No, we did not study because it was only single dose, so this was not part of the study. The objective was only safety and tolerability and PK.
Okay. Thank you very much. Our penultimate paper will be presented by Professor Trip Gulick from Cornell University on behalf of the ACTG investigators, entitled ACTG 5211, Phase 2 Study of Safety and Efficacy of Vicrovirok in HIV-infected treatment-experienced patients. Trip?
Thank you very much, Andrew. I'm very pleased to present the results of AIDS Clinical Trials Group Study 5211, which is a Phase 2 study of Vicrovirok, the investigational CCR5 inhibitor in treatment-experienced subjects, on behalf of the protocol team. Our study objectives, the primary objective of ACTG-5211 was to evaluate the virologic activity of three doses of Vicrovirok at 14 days. Our main secondary objectives at weeks 24 and 48 were to assess the safety and tolerability of Vicrovirok and to evaluate the virologic and immunologic activity of Vicrovirok with optimized antiretroviral therapy and to assess co-receptor switching. Our study population were ART-experienced adults with viral load levels of at least 5,000 copies per mil while taking a ritonavir-containing regimen. They had documented R5-only viral phenotype using the monogram co-receptor tropism assay, and they were stratified by both enfuvirtide use and baseline CD4, either less than or at least 50 cells per microliter. Study design. Patients entered the study taking a failing antiretroviral therapy regimen and underwent screening with both genotypic and phenotypic drug resistance testing, as well as viral tropism determination. At study entry, they continued their regimen and were randomized to one of four study arms, placebo or Vicrovirok at 5, 10, or 15 milligrams given once a day. The randomized study treatment was added to their failing antiretroviral therapy regimen, and they were followed for 2 weeks, at which point the primary efficacy endpoint was determined. At that same visit, patients and their providers were allowed to optimize the antiretroviral therapy regimen based on treatment history and drug resistance testing, and follow-up continued through weeks 24 and 48. All ART regimens included 100 to 800 milligrams of ritonavir. We powered the study to detect at least a 0.7 log difference in viral load level between, in pairwise comparisons, between the Vicrovirok arms and the placebo arm. And there were crossover options written into the protocol for patients who experienced virologic failure. We enrolled 118 subjects with a median age of 46, 92% men, 8% women. A third were people of color, and 66% were white. The median viral load level was about 36,000 copies, and the CD4 cell count, 146 cells per microliter. A third were enfuvirtide experienced, and per protocol, 100% had documented R5 tropic virus at the screening visit. One development on the study was that our independent study monitoring committee on October 6th of 2005 recommended to stop the lowest dose, the Vicrovirok 5 milligram dose, and offer the patients an increase in Vicrovirok to 15 milligrams because of trends for increased co-receptor switching, for suboptimal virologic responses, and the decision to stop the lowest dose Vicrovirok arm on a Schering-sponsored treatment-naive study. This slide shows the primary endpoint of the study. This is the mean change in viral load level at 14 days in an intent-to-treat analysis. As you can see, there's really no change in viral load level in the placebo arm. All three Vicrovirok arms are associated with a viral load drop of approximately one log below baseline levels by the end of 14 days. This shows the extended mean changes in HIV RNA levels over the course of 24 weeks in an intent-to-treat analysis. I'll remind you at 2 weeks that patients were allowed to optimize their background regimen based on treatment history and drug resistance testing. What you see is that in the placebo group, approximately a 0.4 log reduction, but that this trends back up towards baseline by the end of 24 weeks. In contrast, all three Vicrovirok arms are associated with a drop in viral load level, and as you can see, this is a durable drop through 24 weeks. At the end of 24 weeks, the Vicrovirok 5 milligram group has a 1.5 log reduction below baseline, the 15 milligram group a 1.7 log reduction, and the 10 milligram group a 1.9 reduction below baseline. This table illustrates other week 24 virologic responses with different endpoints. If one looks at the proportion in each group who had a drop in viral load level of at least a log below baseline, you can see 18% of the placebo group compared with 61% of the Vicrovirok 5 milligram, and about 70% in the 10 and 15 milligram arms achieved this endpoint. Looking at the proportion less than 400 copies per mil at week 24, 11% of the placebo group, 43% of the 5-milligram group, and about 50% of the 10 and 15-milligram groups achieved that endpoint. And finally, less than 50 copies per mil, 7% of the placebo group, 26% of the 5-milligram group, 40% of the 10-milligram group, and 27% of the 15-milligram group. CD4 cell changes are illustrated here over 24 weeks. The placebo group actually falls below baseline CD4 cell count at weeks 24. You can see steady rises in all three of the Vicrobiroc groups with an intermediate response in the 5-milligram group of approximately 80 cells over baseline, and in the 10 and 15-milligram groups, approximately 140 cells over baseline. Tropism. As I mentioned at screening, we designed the protocol that all patients would have documentation of R5-only tropic virus at screening. However, this was redetermined at study entry prior to the administration of study drug. 86% of patients continued to have R5-only tropic virus. However, 12 or 10% switched their tropism to either dual or mixed. That is, now had the detection of X4 virus. And an additional 4 patients had missing values at study entry. If you follow the 106 patients with either R5 or missing values on study treatment, 13 experienced switches in viral tropism over the course of the study. 1 in the placebo group, 7 in the 5-milligram group, 3 in the 10-milligram, and 2 in the 15-milligram. We did a post hoc subset analysis looking at the virologic response of patients who were randomized to Vicrobiroc at either 10 or 15 milligrams and looked at their virologic response at week 24. Of the 71 patients who had R5 tropic virus at entry, one can see a 1.8 log reduction in viral load level by the end of week 24. Compare that with the 10 patients who had dual or mixed virus at study entry, who had a 0.8 log reduction by the end of 24 weeks. And this is statistically significant, favoring the R5-only tropic arm. Adverse events, we saw no significant differences for grade 3 or 4 adverse events in pairwise comparisons among the 4 arms. No seizures, which had been reported in animal studies, were reported on this clinical trial. 5 subjects were randomized to Vicrobiroc, developed malignancies over the course of the study. 1 on 15 milligrams with a history of Hodgkin's disease developed non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. 1 on 10 milligrams with a history of Hodgkin's disease developed recurrent Hodgkin's disease. 1 patient on 15 milligrams without a history of malignancy developed gastric adenocarcinoma, and 2 patients on the 5-milligram dose without a history of malignancy developed either non-Hodgkin's or Hodgkin's disease. In addition, 2 subjects randomized to the placebo arm developed malignancies. 1 developed cutaneous squamous cell carcinomas, and a 2nd who had taken placebo for 7 months, then crossed over to Vicrobiroc 10 milligrams following virologic failure, eventually discontinuing the drug due to lack of response, and 1 month later developed a localized perianal squamous cell carcinoma. In conclusion, ACTG 5211 shows that in treatment-experienced patients, Vicrobiroc at 5, 10, or 15 milligrams with ritonavir demonstrates potent 14-day virologic suppression. And following optimization of the background regimen, Vicrobiroc at either 10 or 15 milligrams with ritonavir demonstrated sustained antiretroviral activity over at least 24 weeks without notable differences between those 2 dosing arms. In a subset analysis, subjects with dual or mixed tropic virus had a reduced virologic response compared with those with R5 tropic virus. Vicrobiroc was generally well tolerated, and because of the small sample size of the study, the relationship to malignancy is uncertain. I'd like to thank the protocol team, particularly my co-chairs, Dan Karitskas and Charlie Flexner, Katie Godfrey from the Division of AIDS, and the multiple investigators and other team members, as well as our pharmaceutical sponsors, Wayne Greaves and Lisa Dunkel from the Schering-Plough Research Institute, and Owen Coakley from Monogram Biosciences, and the main study sponsor, the Division of AIDS, from NIAID and NIH. Also, the 25 ACTG sites that enrolled patients, and last but certainly not least, our study participants. Thanks.
Thank you, Tripp. We have time for one quick question. Okay, if not, I've just been handed this from Sharon Walmsley. We're going to add 3 more late breakers Just kidding. Oh, there's one question here. Okay, go ahead. Don't run out. It was just a joke.
It's very okay. Quick. Trip, that was great. How many patients did you screen in total to get your 118 who were only R5?
So we screened our treatment-experienced patients for tropism, and approximately 50% of the treatment-experienced seen at ACTG sites were eligible for the study. The other 50%, the vast majority, had dual-mixed virus and were ineligible for the study.
Okay. Thank you, Tripp. Our last paper, we've done it, is going to be presented by Robin Hardwick from Tanox Pharmaceuticals, entitled TNX355. In combination with optimized background regimen, achieved statistically significant viral load reduction and CD4 cell count increase when compared with OBR alone in phase 2 study at 48 weeks.
Hi, I hear that the Canadians saved the best for last, eh? I want to start by first off thanking the Canadians for their hospitality. This has been wonderful. And thank Dr. Stanley Lewis and colleagues for allowing me to present this data to you this afternoon. And Dr. Stanley Lewis also would like to send his regrets for not being able to be here to present this himself. First, I'm going to provide an overview of TNX355. It is a humanized monoclonal antibody that is a viral entry inhibitor. It inhibits entry of HIV into the lymphocytes themselves. It binds to the epitope in the second domain of the CD4 cell. It's administered by twice monthly IV infusions. It's effective in vitro against a broad spectrum of primary clinical isolates, and it is non-immunosuppressive. It's indicated currently for the treatment of experienced patients, and the status right now, it has received fast track from the FDA. The structure of the HIV envelope protein can be perceived as very complex by many, and you can see that there's many sites of pharmacologic prevention. What's important for TNX355 is to note that it binds to the second domain, so it prevents the conformational changes to gain access to the chemokine receptors. This cartoon actually depicts the 355 mechanism of action in a little bit of closer view, so that you can note that it blocks the conformation so HIV can't actually get in, thus saving the immunologic state. So let's take a moment and look at the actual clinical trial design for this phase 2 study. And it's 48 weeks with 24-week primary endpoint. There are 82 triple-class experienced patients that were enrolled in this trial. It's a double-blind, placebo-controlled, randomized study. And viral loads of greater than or equal to 10,000 copies and CD4 counts of 50 or better. Phenosense GTs were done prior to the selection of the optimized background therapy, and they were switched to open label 355 plus a new background therapy at failure. So the primary endpoint was to find the mean viral load reduction from baseline at week 24. And secondary endpoints include the percent of the subjects who actually achieved a viral load reduction of at least half log drop, percent of subjects who achieve a viral load reduction of at least one log, and change in percentage and number of CD4 cell counts from baseline. And virologic failure was defined as greater than more of a half log decrease from baseline. The demographics you can see here are pretty evenly matched in relation to the 10 milligram arm, the 15 milligram arm, and placebo, as far as age, race, gender, baseline RNA, viral load, and the baseline CD4 count. So the primary endpoints at 24 weeks actually indicate a mean viral load reduction from the baseline was statistically significant. And then more importantly, at week 48, we were able to maintain this virologic reduction. And I want you to keep in mind that we're not comparing between 15 and 10 milligrams. We're comparing each of those to placebo. So time to virologic, time to loss of virologic response compares in number of days. Week 48 immunologic results, you can see here that the 15 milligram arm actually had about a 51 cell increase, and the 10 milligram arm had roughly a 48 cell increase. Now looking at the treatment emergent adverse events of grade 2 or greater severity at 48 weeks, I just want you to take note that I'm going to show the entire list. So every treatment emergent event is going to be indicated here. And the N could be the same individual because it is treatment emergent. Also keep in mind as you peruse over this list that all of these subjects were on optimized background therapy as well. Grade 3 to 4 laboratory abnormalities at 48 weeks were pretty rare, and there really were no differences among the arms, and all abnormalities are shown, as you can see here. So in summary, the statistically significant viral load reduction was achieved. There was a significant increase in CD4 cells. Minimal side effects were noted compared to placebo. There were no severe adverse events related to the study drug, and that was per blinded investigator assessment. There were no infusion site reactions noted. It's active against multiple strains, active against CCR5 and CXCR4 tropic viruses, and there are no drug-drug interactions. I want to take a moment and just acknowledge the patients that did enroll in this trial. I also want to acknowledge all the fellow investigators. Many are here in the audience. And all of the research coordinators and everyone else who strives to continue to find better treatment options for patients. Thank you.
We have time for a couple of questions. If not, that ends the marathon. I'd like to thank, on behalf of my co-chairs, all the presenters for making this a rewarding experience. And I think all of you deserve a big round of applause for hanging in there with us. Thank you.